This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Kings of Sport, the program that's changing the game one show at a time, with your hosts, Nate Milton.
Yes! That boy's good!
And Marcus Vandenberg.
Let's say!
So sit back and relax, because you're now down with the Kings. And welcome to the show that's...
Yeah, we're keeping it. We're keeping it solid.
We'll do it live.
What you meant to say was... Nah, don't get quiet now. It's still recording.
And welcome to the program that's changing the game one show at a time, a.k.a. the world's most dangerous sports show, a.k.a. iTunes' longest-running weekly episodic podcast produced and hosted by two or more African-Americans that are not affiliated with a major network. It is the Kings of Sport podcast, the program that's causing a panic all around the planet, from New York to Newfoundland, Boise to Boston, Fargo to Fresno, Ontario to Orlando, South Bronx to the North Pole, and all points in between. It is our Christmas episode. Happy holidays, everyone out there. I'm the Godfather, Nate Milton, joined as always by my partner in crime that is already proven to be problematic this week, Marcus Vandenberg. Well, what's going on, Marcus?
How dare you? Happy holidays.
Yeah, it was supposed to be CMB, man. We all we got. Yeah,
so little Easter egg for the fans.
It is our holiday episode. Happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, and Happy Kwanzaa to everybody out there. And we're going to get in the holiday spirit with some great discussions. But it is also our best of 2014 episode. The next time you hear us after this week, it will be a new year. So we're going to go back and listen to some of our favorite interviews, some of our best discussions, and some of our most heated arguments.
Yeah, the argument thing. And that was a little awkward listening, going back last night to listen to some of that stuff. And I get annoyed easily, as I found out.
Yeah, you get annoyed easily. You're not a good teammate. You're not a helpful person by nature.
Well, I did.
You're basically Kobe Bryant. The only thing you didn't do is you didn't yell at Mr. Podbean and say, "I need some more help out here."
What if I'm Kobe? What does that make Alfred then? Because he
Swaggy P.
Is he Shaq? Someone had to leave town.
Somebody had to leave town. he might be Steve Nash. He might be, because he just kind of dipped on us.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So we will hear from the aforementioned Alfred Cunningham in taped recorded audio form later on in the show.
Yeah, but nothing new, folks. Don't get your hopes up. I'm telling you, it's not happening.
Maybe. You never know, Marcus. It might be a Christmas miracle.
How long ago did we send that message on Facebook to him?
About a week ago.
Yeah, it's not happening.
But we did want to get some good discussion, good conversation going about something that is kind of a staple of the holiday season, and that is the holiday movie, the holiday special. You know, you can't walk past a wall of TVs in a department store without seeing, you know, The Grinch, Charlie Brown, Frosty the Snowman, Rudolph, So we're like, you know what, Marcus, let's talk about it. And since this is Christmas, we're going to bring back the list, the segment we used to do where we talk to the audience and they sent us their opinions and we gave our opinions. And this week we're going to talk about our favorite Christmas movies / holiday specials.
This should be interesting because, you know, I'm not a big movie guy, but I do like Christmas, so coming up with this list is pretty easy for me.
I thought we were going to get the Mike Tyson punch-out montage with jingle bell sounds behind it.
No, there's no holiday training montage that I know of, unless it's a cheat code that I'm not aware of.
Well, let's go to the listeners first. We got a couple of responses, not a whole lot, but you know, it's the holiday season. I'm sure people are getting ready to spend time with their loved ones, but we did get a couple of responses on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thekingsofsport, and let's check those out right now.
All right, let's see here. Looking at Henry's response. Starting with Steve Chassan, top three Christmas movies: Jingle All the Way, Lethal Weapon, and Gremlins.
Okay. I can see one of those, maybe two of those.
Evil Evan, Gremlins, Die Hard, and a personal favorite of mine that didn't make my list: Saved by the Bell, A Home for Christmas two-parter, where Zach dates homeless girl at the mall.
I forgot all about that one.
This has been on my mind recently because I have Saved by the Bell set on my DVR as a season pass on MTV2. Don't ask questions. Don't ask stupid questions like that. I mean, why not? Why not? And MTV2 has not yet aired the Christmas special this year or this month. And I'm waiting for it to pop up on my DVR. And we're 2 days out. No luck yet. Maybe a Christmas miracle will happen tomorrow night. You don't understand. He dated a homeless girl. That's how good his game was. He was picking up homeless chicks at the mall.
I don't know how good your game has to be to date a homeless girl, though. Like it doesn't take much to impress her.
I mean, assuming she was clean and smelled good, what's you wouldn't know.
I've actually got a story, but I'm not going to tell on this podcast. Maybe next year.
Is it about a homeless girl at the mall?
She wasn't at the mall, but she was round the way.
She was homeless?
Done. She didn't, let's say she didn't, she was, between homes. How about that?
Mm.
She had places to stay at night, but none of those places had her name on the mortgage.
Hmm. Interesting. Henry Thompson. Yeah, Henry Thompson the second. It's a Wonderful Life, Scrooged, and Die Hard.
Okay.
So, that's, and then he also listed his favorite segments, which we'll get into later, so.
Okay. So far from the three responses we got from Steve, Evan, and Brother Henry, the consensus seems to be Gremlins, which got two votes, and Die Hard, which got two votes.
Now, I have not seen Gremlins. Does this actually count as a Christmas movie?
Yeah, it does. I was never a fan of Gremlins back in the day. It was okay. I think there was a cartoon series though, and I think I like the cartoon series better than the movie. But yeah, Gremlins counts. Die Hard, I think, is one of those sleepers. Like you never really think about it as a Christmas movie, but it's like, yeah, this might be one of the best Christmas movies ever. So we'll see if you or I have either of those on our list. But I'll let you go first, Marcus, in the spirit of the giving season. What are your top three Christmas movies or holiday specials?
All right, so this was tough. And the top three is really going to be 1A, 1B, and 1C. I don't really have a preference.
Did you break up the Saved by the Bell episode into two separate choices?
I didn't even think about that until I just read that on Facebook. But that would be 1D. It wouldn't make the top three. So first up would be Home Alone, a classic. Okay. I really don't need to, you know, explain more as to why this is on my list. It's one of those movies that, you know, it wouldn't be Christmas time without it on TBS. Number two on my list is Die Hard, as you mentioned. And you know, you can, when I asked about Gremlins, you know, I feel like you do see Die Hard on the TV more during the holidays as opposed to Gremlins. I never noticed Gremlins popping up on my schedule during Christmas, but I always see Die Hard on at this time of the year. And you know, it's loosely based on Christmas, in quotations. But it's still a great film, and if you can, you know, ignore the fact that it might not be technically a Christmas film, just more of a ass-kicking film, then, you know, it makes my list. And the 1C on my list is one of my favorite movies of all time, Love Actually. Say something.
I'm just learning more about you as this year goes on, Marcus. Love Actually, Gilmore Girls.
Say just something.
Learn about your sensitive side. So why is Love Actually on your list, Marcus?
Because it's awesome. It's the best way to describe it. It's a collection of love stories wrapped into one bigger plot, the movie's mostly based in England, but there's a couple scenes that involve the U.S. A pretty diverse cast starring Hugh Grant.
Was that did that movie come out before or after the prostitute scandal?
Ooh. Came out in 2003.
Okay, I think that was after. Yeah.
After, yeah.
Speaking of picking up homeless girls.
Yeah, exactly. yeah, Hugh Grant, Emma Thompson, Alan Rickman, speaking of Die Hard. Colin Firth. It's a pretty diverse, pretty impressive staff of cast members. Well, it's weird that I have Hans Gruber in two of my top three.
Yes. Yeah. You know why?
Why?
Because he's got diplomatic immunity.
And yeah, it's one of those touching love stories. There's nothing wrong with love. I'm in love. It happens. But there's also some funny stuff in the movie. Have you seen the movie, Nate?
I've seen bits and pieces.
Don't fight it, Nate. Embrace it. You know you want to watch it.
I mean, I do like a good rom-com.
Yeah, it's a very good rom-com.
Man, I might have to check it out.
So
you got Die Hard, Love Actually, and what was the other one?
Home Alone. Uh-huh.
Okay, that's solid. That's solid. I actually agree with you on one of those choices, so I'll go ahead and get that out of the way. And that is Die Hard, which I think is, like I said, man, it's a sleeper Christmas movie, but it's great. It's one of my favorite action movies of all time. Not only do you have Bruce Willis at his best, not only do you have a good villain, but you have Carl Winslow playing a very significant supporting role.
Yes.
And you know what? Like, I saw, this is a couple years ago, some guy had a theory, you know, these crazy fan theories that people come up with about movies.
Mm-hmm.
He had a theory that Reginald Bell Johnson's character in Die Hard was actually Carl Winslow before he moved to Chicago.
Mm.
Like, after all that stuff went down with John McClane, he was like, you know what? I need to settle down and get about this lifestyle. And he moved to Chicago, met Harriet Winslow, and that's when Family Matters started.
That is a great theory.
I want to believe it. Like, I want to believe it's the same universe where Steve Urkel and Hans Gruber coexist.
It's probably not true, but, I mean, it's believable.
Yeah, I buy it.
Look at how it all plays out. Yeah, it I could buy that. But what happens to Ardell, the limo driver?
Huh.
Does he factor in? Does he have a role?
I think it's been a while since I read this guy's theory, but I think Carl was the main one he focused on. Like, McClane. Like, it's crazy because everybody that was involved in his life in Die Hard,
mm-hmm.
He cut contact with them, like, almost in some sort of witness protection deal. Where he never brings up John McClane, he never brings up Argyle, he never brings up the events of that Christmas night.
Speaking of our man Argyle, He had a big gap in his IMDb resume from 1992 to 2000, and then he had one credit in 2000, and then nothing until 2012. So
he just rested up.
Just letting them chats off Die Hard, man.
So Die Hard is my first Christmas movie. The second movie is Jingle All the Way.
Oh, no.
The first one with Sinbad and former governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Now, if you haven't seen this movie in a while, it's the story of a father that's, I wouldn't say he's a good man, but he's not a bad man. He's just doing the best he can. And his son wants a Turbo Man action figure. And he waits until Christmas Eve to try to get this Turbo Man action figure. And hilarity ensues as he goes and goes through all these trials and tribulations. He ends up teaming up at some point with Sinbad, who's a postal worker who wants the same thing. And then they end up fighting. And Sinbad somehow hijacks the Macy's parade and becomes Turbo Man. And Schwarzenegger fights him in the thing. And it's a real crazy, convoluted scenario. But I always found that movie enjoyable.
Yeah, never seen it.
So you've seen Love Actually, but you haven't seen Jingle All the Way. You're missing out.
Who's at the better IMDb rating?
Hey, I'm not talking about critical reviews. I'm talking about what your heart feels. And I will say, I know we got some wrestling fans in the audience. Like, there's no way possible that I don't care how bad you think Jingle All the Way is. There's no way it's going to be remotely as bad as the new one with Larry the Cable Guy.
That was my next question. Are you going to watch the second one?
No. It is tarnished, the Jingle All the Way legacy. I don't think it's part of the canon. If Sinbad doesn't show up in it, I disown this movie. Well, I already disowned the movie, but Sinbad is the only thing that can make it slightly better. Just popping up is like, hey, don't do that, man. I did that last time.
So no Santino for you. All right.
No Santino. Like, just look at the depth that you talk about your boy Argyle with the big gaps. Look at the big gap between the talent. You went from Arnold Schwarzenegger to Larry the Cable Guy and from Sinbad to Santino Marella. That's terrible. That's terrible. Like, yeah, so I will not be watching Jingle All the Way Part 2. But my final movie, Marcus, and this is a movie that if you haven't seen, you should watch, because it is, you know, I'm not big into the all-time quote-unquote American classic films, but this is one that I will ride with, and that's It's a Wonderful Life. I agree with Brother Henry on this one. It's a Wonderful Life. It still resonates. It's still a good story, and it's funny because we've seen so many, like if you've watched any sitcoms or cartoons over the last 15, 20, 25 years, you've seen a version of this, whether it was, I think Al Bundy had a version of It's a Wonderful Life. I know American Dad had a version of It's a Wonderful Life. Like, it's a trope now, but this movie is really good. It's got Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed, who I didn't know that she did anything other than the Donna Reed Show. Shout out to Nick at Night. But yeah, it's a good movie. George Bailey, you know, he having a hard time, and he about to commit suicide and jump off a bridge, and then the angel Clarence comes in and says, no, George, don't do it. You know, I don't even mind that there's not a lot of black people in this movie. That's how much I like this movie, Marcus.
Are there any black people?
I think like maybe one of the mailmen, the gardener or somebody.
Gardener. That's code for
yeah
worker.
That's how much I like this movie. I don't even mind that George Bailey is living in a neighborhood that is not the most integrated.
Well, considering the time it was filmed, it made sense.
Yeah, and George, like I don't think George Bailey would have had a problem with black people living next door. He seemed to be nice to everybody, except for himself.
If you thought he was suicidal before then.
Like, no, Clarence, I can't do it.
Jovan moves in and he's like, I'm out. I can't deal.
You should hear the music. yeah, so that's my list. I got It's a Wonderful Life, Jingle All the Way, and of course, I think we, with the listener votes and our votes, we can give Die Hard the crown of best Christmas movie as voted by the Kings of Sport.
Yeah, that I think it's one for sure.
Yeah, and I really do want to believe that Carl Winslow theory.
I believe it now. I'm all in.
Like, he was like, man, I got to go. Danny Glover was always saying he was getting too old for it, but he kept coming back. Carl was like, nah, man, I'm good. And then he moved to Chicago and met Steve Urkel. And that was that.
Speaking of Christmas movies, I started watching Mitt Foley's documentary on I Am Santa. Have you heard about this?
Really? No, I didn't even hear about that.
Basically, he was going around, him and Morgan Spurlock, to basically document what it's like for people who play Santa.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of the movie is sort of Mitt Foley explaining why he wants to become Santa Claus. I've only watched like 15 minutes, and I started watching something else, but I'm going to finish it today. It's interesting. It's on Netflix, if you have it.
Okay, I might watch that over the holidays. My nieces are going to be in town, so I'm sure we'll have some silliness and watch cartoons. But when they tire out and from all the sugar and everything, I might hop on Netflix. I got a couple days off from work, so I might check that out. Do they go into a Santa Claus, or are you not that far yet?
I'm not that far yet. but it does feature, I mean, so far it's featured like Blue Meanie talking about Foley and Lawler and Dreamer and all these wrestlers that are in it.
They show when Del Rio ran over Santa? Because you got to put that.
I don't think it showed that part, no.
Oh, wrestling. Yeah, wrestling, speaking of things that kind of tie everything together and bring us together. Wrestling, if you think about it, Marcus, might have been one of the things that broke this show apart.
You can call us the Shield.
So, yeah, we got a lot of great stuff to talk about this week, man. We got the best of segment 4. We got the best of some of our interviews that we've done over the past year. But I think up next, because... we've mentioned him enough. I think we're going to tip our cap to our departed co-host, Alfred Big Nasty Kanawha, and give you the best, in quotes, of Alfred on this show last year, especially his interactions and discussions with one Marcus Vandenberg over professional wrestling.
How's that Bray Wyatt angle working out? All these months later.
Yeah, we're still talking about Bray Wyatt. So grab your eggnog, grab your fruitcake, and settle in, because it's going to be this kind of show. So we'll be back with the best of 2014 as the Kings of Sport year in review.
Keeping that one in, too.
See, that's no help, man. That's why Alfred left. We'll be back right after this.
What in the wide, wide world of sports is going on here?
Scene was so thick, low rise, 77 Seville's, L Dog, nothing but them blacks, all the players, all the hustlers. I'm talking about a black man heaven here. You know what I'm saying?
It's beginning to look a lot like wood. Follow my every step, take notes on how I crap. We are back on the Kings of Sport. Marcus and Nate holding things down on this very special Best of 2014 edition of the podcast. And before we get into this next segment, Marcus, I want to say welcome. I want to say hello. I want to say bonjour. I want to say salam alaikum. I want to say tien stellen to our new listeners. Sorry, big increase of membership over the past weekend on our Facebook page, facebook.com/KingsOfSport. And ironically, Marcus, a lot of the number of those people were from Africa, were from South Africa, and it was very interesting to me.
Yeah, it made you wonder. If you're listening to this, new listener, tweet me, Marco Will, MarcoWill, and yeah, just let us know that you discovered the show via our promotion ad, and just curious to see if you're actually listening to the show.
Yeah, and it's the reason why it's so interesting to me is because we see an increase in viewers from Africa, and this past year, as many of you know, we saw a decrease in co-hosts from Africa.
Yeah, from one to none.
For those of you that don't know, we used to have a three-man crew here at the Kings of Sport. It was myself, Marcus, of course, and our third man was Alfred Big Nasty Cunawa of Bleacher Report, and he is Liberian. He was the darkness to Marcus's lightness, and you know, we had some good times, had some rocky times, but and it was all real and it was all fun on the show. And we enjoyed him when he was here, but you know, what's that old cliche? We had creative differences.
Basically, yeah. You know, he CM Punk'd us. Basically, that's what really happened. minus the contract situation, but
yeah,
he just walked out.
So, but you know, we know that you guys enjoyed Alfred when he was on the show, because he, whether you loved him or hated him, he always made things interesting. And especially when Alfred and Marcus would get into it, I would just kind of sit back and just enjoy the conversation. And so I think this segment, Marcus, we're going to look back at some of our greatest conversations with Alfred, including when Alfred's car was stolen. I don't know if you guys out there remember that. We're going to talk about the infamous Bray Wyatt piece, because I think, you know, that is, if you really want to know where things started fracturing, like, that was when it was evident to me that.
No, that started in January with Aaron Andrews.
It did, but it didn't become evident until Bray Wyatt. Like, I was like, okay. Like the Aaron Andrews blow up was funny to me, but the Bray Wyatt thing was that was kind of what would you call that? The straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah, Bray Wyatt was definitely the finger poke of doom for us in terms of, like, all right, enough.
Yeah, so for those of you that missed it, and for those of you that want to relive it, here are some of our favorite moments with our bar-hopping, show-stopping, controversy-starting, and Kings of Sport departing.
Ooh.
Alfred Cunawa. You like that?
I like that.
Yeah. All right. So here's some of our best moments with Alfred from 2014, and we'll be back with more after this.
Yeah, so what happened with the car?
Oh, man. Like, my brother had just left to get food, a week and a half ago, and then came back, and he's like, your car is out in the lot. I thought he was fucking with me, and then, like, it was gone. So, like, we reported to the police, and the police don't do shit about anything. They just wait for things to fall in the lap. So I actually ended up getting pretty impatient after a couple of days. I need my car. I didn't want to rent a car for too long. And I just kind of got with somebody who I've been connected with in the political world, who does, like, private investigation and stuff like that. So he asked me, like, 1,000 questions. And he was able to actually track down the guy who did it.
Wow.
And there's actually a guy who works here. And he had been, like, breaking into cars. And we just got a notice today. He'd been breaking into cars and stealing cars, like, several of them.
Works at the office?
And so, like, in the maintenance crew.
Oh, damn.
And it was like 17 years. And it made complete sense because, like, what happened is I have my, this is how I knew that they got my car immediately, is because I have my spare key. in like a certain drawer that, you know, I thought was a good hiding place. But they had broken into my place and they got, I mean, they went to all through all my drawers, but then they got my spare key and that's how they, you know, my got my car.
Whoa, so they broke into your apartment first?
Yes.
And then took you, wow.
Because I was in Santa Barbara, that one night weekend, and when I came back, like, somebody had broken into my home. Like, I called the police about it. They didn't really, like, I didn't think they took anything. I didn't even think about my spare key that had been taken. And, like, they just took the spare key. I guess I don't know what they wanted to do with my car, but we were able to track them down.
What a genius plan.
it kind of was. I mean, if they weren't fucking with me, they obviously have been getting away with it.
Wow.
You can't have one set of standards for the players and then another set of standards for the people that employ the players, who should be, by all accounts, held to a higher standard. And so,
right.
I'm interested to see what he does with Ursa.
Absolutely. And some are already calling that, you know, owners and NFL GMs need to have drug testing, mandatory drug testing, because this is not the first time this has happened, not only with Jim Irsay, but we saw that instance where separate Broncos executives were cited for DUIs. So they absolutely, if anybody needs to be held to the same standard as players, as owners, and I don't even think they need to be held to the same standard, greater standards. They should be even more scrutinized for these types of actions because the entire franchise is in their hands. They can't just get cut, you know, in a lot of these positions. They're the ones making the decisions.
And you talk about owners and executives, you know, getting into stuff like this. I've always had a suspicion. I don't have proof of it, but let's just say allegedly, I've always had the feeling that Jerry Jones is on some type of drug, because you can't tell me that your face just melt that way, and that's not plastic surgery. He got to be taking some type of controlled substance to make his face morph and change in that fashion.
I think it's called Botox. I don't know if that's a drug or not, but.
And Kenny Rogers on that stuff.
Some of the decisions he makes on the Cowboys front offices do seem like he's on drugs. The fact that he still has Jason Garrett around, maybe Jason Garrett is the one supplying him. Maybe he has that stash, and if he lets him go, he's not going to be able to get his fix.
It's like, and this is also why I like when Mark is in here sometimes, because we can talk about comic book stuff and sci-fi stuff. You remember that Batman the Animated Series?
Of course.
And you remember Clayface?
Yes.
You remember Clayface? When I'm like the very first time he showed up, when he was just a regular dude that was turned into Clayface, he had to keep going back and getting that chemical so he could stay a regular dude.
Yeah.
I think that's what Jason Garrett has on Jerry Jones. Like, come on.
Yeah, no, it's a good one. I like that.
You're like, come on, Jerry, you don't want to turn into a monster again, do you? All right, I'll re-sign you for another year. Oh, but yeah, I don't know. I don't know what Goodell does to Ursay. I mean, something's got to happen. Tony Dungy has come out, former Colts head coach, led him to a Super Bowl, led him to two Super Bowls and one title, has said that, you know, something needs to be done here. And I don't think that's sour grapes from Tony's perspective. I think, you know, he's probably one of the most honest people in sports, and especially in the NFL. And I think he's genuinely concerned for this dude. And, you know, it is a funny story to some extent, but it's also like, if you are that influential in a sport and especially in a town, you know, Marcus was just in Indianapolis. It's not called Naptown for a reason. It's not like there's a lot of things going on in that city. And the Ursays pretty much are royalty in that town, especially with Peyton Manning not being there anymore. And it's like you have to know who you are and where you are. And it just shows a lapse in judgment. And I think something's got to be done.
Yeah, and you mentioned Tony Dungy. Tony Dungy is one of the most non-judgmental people in the NFL. He's like the godfather. He's like the Dalai Lama. Not only does he look like Gandhi, but he's got a Gandhi-like influence. He's somebody who's worked with Jonathan Martin and Michael Vick, people in very difficult situations, and it came out in support of them. But when Tony Dungy comes out and says that something needs to be done in spite of you, that's when you know you've hit bottom and something really does need to be done. Because I'm not taking that as sour grapes. Tony Dungy's not going to make a comment like that just in jest. He legitimately feels that way, and Dungy's opinion is as valid as anybody's in the NFL.
Yeah, Tony Dungy's not Marcus Vick. Like, Jim Irsay still on that bullshit?
Yeah, he's literally still on that bullshit.
Yeah. So that's Jim Irsay. We had to give y'all some cracky tales this week. some Xanax tales, but yeah, it's a bad look. And as much as I have not liked some of Ursay's comments, at the end of the day, we're all human, so hopefully he can get it together.
Yeah, and I don't think anybody particularly likes them, like, other than Colts fanatics, but it's something that's just a fun caveat to have. Like, I wish every owner had some kind of character, but I guess that's what makes it Jerry Jones and Jim Ursay for the world stand out, is that they're the owners who aren't afraid to just be themselves.
Because they own them drugs, baby. Allegedly. Allegedly with Jerry Jones. I don't need those problems.
KK on the beats.
I mean, for all intents and purposes, you know, this WWE, anything could happen, as they always say. They could go back to a Shield Wyatt feud.
Oh, please no.
I mean, it. I don't want to see it, but they could very well say that's, fans were excited about that once upon a time. Let's go back to that. Because I feel they're almost in a scramble mode right now.
Yeah. And that's the funny thing. What do they do with the Wyatts or Bray Wyatt? Like, where? I think anything they do with him, they can easily have an explanation. They can come up with something creatively, because the Bray Wyatt character is just so easy to book, I think. But what does he do? He's with John Cena. There's nowhere to go but down.
Yeah.
Unless you feud for the top title. So they really need to be careful as to how they book him from here on out.
You know what would have been a great feud with a guy that I think fans would have bought as a better babyface than John Cena, and also a guy that, you know, you could have realistically, in the three-match setup, given Bray Wyatt the two wins to one advantage and really put Bray Wyatt over? That man called Sting. Like, can you imagine? I'm serious. Can you imagine if they did the same program? I'm going to destroy your heroes with a guy that is actually a hero, because John Cena is not a hero.
No, John Cena's a hero to the WWE. Sting is a nobody to WWE. You're running a big risk of having these kids go like, who's his old man daddy? Like, he's not a hero.
That's why you have to educate the audience.
We just mentioned with Paige, they don't do a good job of doing that. So why would you think they would do something with Sting when they don't do something with their current talent? Once again, you give them too much credit here.
With live audiences, you do get a lot of the snarky fans, the male fans. That's why you're always going to hear Cena sucks chance. That's the portion of the crowd that I think would pop for Sting. They're outer type, so I think you could make Sting's return a big deal. Now, Sting versus Bray Wyatt I think would make perfect sense, especially now that The Undertaker is out. But I just think getting there, WWE would know what to do, and I just couldn't see it happening in the realm of reality and WWE's booking. But if you write that on paper, like that, I mean, where is Bray Wyatt going to go? He's going to look minor league no matter what he does, because he's feuded with John Cena for 3 months. So they need to be careful.
Money in the bank.
Yeah, they can do that.
Yeah, honestly, yeah, I was going to say, outside of Sting, which I have no faith that they would do properly, but I do think those characters work well together.
I don't think he has a contract yet, so if he hasn't signed by yet, then what is he waiting for?
And yeah, I don't know if there's really any incentive other than the money, because the match that he was coming in for is probably not going to happen now.
No, it shouldn't happen.
And the only other match I think that could be interesting is Bray Wyatt, maybe John Cena, but those are the only two.
Yeah.
But in terms of Bray Wyatt, the only other match I'm interested in seeing him in is with Daniel Bryan. And I guess the only way you can get there is by having Bray win the Money in the Bank.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He keeps talking about wanting to be a god, and there's one way to be a god in the realms of WWE is you win that title, because the Bray Wyatt character doesn't want competitive glory. He's not a competitor. He's not a warrior who wants to work hard and work his way to the top. He just wants power. He wants control. And that's the way that they can explain him going after the WWE World Heavyweight Championship.
I thought you were going to say beat JBL. To be a wrestling god, you have to beat a wrestling god.
A god.
Hold my hat, Michael.
Let me go do a job, Michael. I'll be right back.
Was that last week on Raw when JBL got involved in the Wyatt feud?
It was this past week, yes.
Yeah, when they took him out. Yeah, like I know it's not going to happen, but yeah, for a one off, I'd kind of be interested in Bray and JBL.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know that they would do Bray and Jerry Lawler if this was before he ever had a heart attack. But I wouldn't be surprised if JBL came out of retirement for a one-off against Bray.
He's not wrestling, man.
He doesn't have to wrestle. He just takes a bump and takes a pinfall. He could just stand in the ring and take the Sister Abigail. Kiss him on the head.
You do his Royal Rumble spot.
Exactly. Get in the ring and take the job and then go, you know, maybe they'll have an excuse to bring back up.
And then what?
And then, you know, Bray Wyatt has got some heat. He's beating somebody that everybody cares about. I'm not going to book the shot somehow. You can't just keep him out there and, Jesus like, have Bray Wyatt cut promo for the rest of his life.
You guys are just pulling shit out your ass now.
So, yeah, so I guess we're qualified to work in WWE Creative.
You are. You graduated from TNA.
Yes.
What the WWE roster can Bray Wyatt, like, just on a throwaway TV match, have a match against and people care? Not very many of them. The roster is very thin. So if you just throw out JBL based on what happened the week before, especially if Bray Wyatt eggs him on, then
you'd be the first person to shit on a 25-second squash match with JBL at a pay-per-view.
I wouldn't. Not at who the hell said anything about pay-per-view? Now, nobody's paying money to see that. I'm saying
no one. But why would you waste a quote-unquote JBL return on Raw?
It's just JBL's at the point in his career where he's. We've seen enough out of wrestling. It's like saying a Jerry Lawler return. Yeah, in his day, he was the king of Memphis, which was arguably the hottest territory in wrestling. But now, if he is to wrestle, it can be given away on free TV easily. And before he had a heart attack, that's what they used to do, is he was like the punching bag.
But I think now that Lawler and JBL are two different. I mean, Lawler is, he's old as shit. Even before the heart attack, he was old. You know, I think JBL is, while he's older, he's still fresh enough in people's minds that you would think if he was going to, quote-unquote, come back, that it would be bigger than a second hour of Raw. You know, it seems like it should be built up more.
His legacy is like the longest reigning champion in SmackDown history. That's like being his legacy of being the two-time CFL world champion. Like, he's really not a legend. He's in the realms of WWE, he's a Hall of Famer and whatnot. But the fact that his commentary career, I think, is now starting to parallel what he did in the ring to where when it's all said and done, we're going to remember him more as a commentator. I think that takes away from his wrestling credibility and him being this big draw that is going to come back for a huge match. I think that's a guy who could take off wearing a shirt and tie, and you know, they'll give him crap about it on the JBL and Cole show. I don't think he'd have a problem doing that.
I mean, that just seems like a waste to do that. And then, okay, that's what, who's going to get revenge for JBL? No one. I don't know.
And that'll just make Bray Wyatt more of a heel, and then you'll want to see him get beat more because
Ron Simmons comes back. Ron Simmons comes back.
He doesn't. Damn.
Oh yeah. I mean, this is a, you know, we're getting a little bit silly, but this is
Barry. When can we move about talking about TNA? Let's move on to TNA.
I was gonna say, but this is before we get to some big TNA news. This is a legit issue that the WWE has with this Bray Wyatt character. I think in a way they've booked themselves into maybe not a corner, but it's a cul-de-sac, and they got to figure out a way to turn it around and get him in there with somebody that the fans are invested in. And
the only guy is
Daniel Bryan.
Let's watch the TV and see what happens. That's a theory. Let's just see what they do with him. Before we sit here and overanalyze what the hell they're doing to Bray Wyatt, let's just see what they're doing.
Hey, welcome to the Kings of Sport. Hey, we're just going to watch the show.
Yeah, but at some point, we just got to move on. We've been beating this to a drum about, oh my God, Bray Wyatt, what are we going to do? Let's just see what happens.
I think JBL and Bray Wyatt is imminent. But speaking of imminent,
let's go on.
We're here. Oh man, hey.
That one is hot fire.
You're the real MVP.
Hustle Gang's gonna be there for Shizzle.
Back to the
with bombs like kids play with toys. One warm December, our hearts will see a world where men are free. Someday at Christmas.
We are back on the Kings of Sport. This is the best of 2014, taking a look back at some of the best moments from the past 365 days. And, you know, Marcus, a lot of times we like to keep things light on the show. We like to have fun. You know, life is stressful enough without getting too serious. But when real deep and real heavy issues arise, you know, we talked about it. You know, we didn't shy away from them, and this year was no exception.
Yeah, I mean, there were several stories that occurred this past year in not only the wrestling world with the Ultimate Warriors untimely death, but also the sports world with Ray Rice in particular, where, you know, we had to take a more serious stance and actually have an intelligent conversation about the topic as opposed to just making jokes. So I think we did a good job at that.
Yeah, you know, we like to, you know, keep it balanced around here. You know, like you mentioned, we did talk about the Ultimate Warrior. I think it was, what, the next day? Because it was right after his passing when we talked about the Warrior.
Yeah, it happened.
It was within 48 hours.
It happened Tuesday. I got home Tuesday. It must have been a Wednesday night when we recorded it, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so that was just, you know, right in the aftermath. You know, and a couple days after that great final speech he gave on Raw. The last public appearance. So, you know, we're going to let you hear what we said about the Warrior. Of course, you know, maybe, you know, I'd argue the biggest sports story of 2014 was Ray Rice and, to a larger extent, the NFL and its behavior policy.
Yeah, domestic violence was the number one, I would say, topic in the sports world. And all of a sudden, finally, we decided to pay attention to domestic violence. For such a long time, it was ignored, and incidents were happening, but it never really caught the attention of the mainstream sports fan. But it wasn't until the Ray Rice video that was released that people actually took notice. So I'm glad that there was an increased attention to such a heinous crime and a heinous act that continues to happen in the sports world.
Yeah, looking back in hindsight, like, just think how powerful that video was. Not only did it, you know, get Ray Rice in trouble, not only did it have the ripple effect of, you know, bringing other NFL players' actions to light, because, you know, I don't think if the Ray Rice thing hadn't happened, I don't think Adrian Peterson would have missed this season. I think that we saw the Players Union and Damora Smith start to chirp a little bit more, which is a good thing, because I think he's been silent for too long on issues, not only of player conduct, but also with the way the NFL disciplines player conduct. And finally, you know, Roger Goodell, I mean, it's crazy to think about now, Marcus, but there was a time for about 3 or 4 weeks where it looked like he might lose his job over this.
Yeah, but he's bounced back, because at the end of the day, it's about money. The NFL's
not only did he bounce back, but he's still implementing policy in terms of player conduct.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, like that is that still baffles me. So yeah, we got into the Ray Rice discussion, and you had a excellent chat with Monique Jones. Where was she at the time?
She was at the Baltimore Sun at the time. She's currently at the USA Today.
Yep, so we're going to play a little bit of that conversation. And since it is bowl season, Marcus, another issue that was kind of bandied about all season long was how we treat players. You know, whether it's talking about players getting in trouble for signing stuff, whether it's talking about giving players a stipend, whether you talk about the Ed O'Bannon lawsuit, or whether you talk about what was the program that just shut down and you saw the emotional reaction from the kids?
Oh, Alabama, Birmingham, UAB.
Yep, UAB. And so it's like, you know, are we still living in this world where we're pretending it's collegiate athletics, or are we actually going to get real and talk about these issues? And it's funny, Marcus, like, now we're in the bowl season. I'm sure folks are going to be enjoying that good turkey, enjoying that good ham while watching a bunch of college football over the next few days. And this is a topic that I think needs to still be brought up.
Quick detour, since you mentioned college football. Did you see the BYU-Memphis game yesterday?
Punk's jump up to get beat down, bro.
Oh, boy.
Like, on the low, like, I know people used to talk about Miami as being a bunch of hoodlums, or, you know, people talk now about Florida State when they're really talking about Jameis Winston mm-hmm. as being bad kids. But BYU on the low, BYU got some thugs.
Man.
BYU ain't nobody to play with.
No. No. And that dude who laid that rabbit punch,
yes.
he deserved that cut he got on his eye, because that wasn't cool at all, man.
Like, when you have people actually throwing, like, Dusty Rhodes bionic elbows in a football game.
And swinging helmets.
Yes. And what was the name of the bowl? Was it the...
The Miami Beach Bowl?
Like, yeah, come on, man. Like, this is not the national championship. This is not, you know, the Rose Bowl. It's the Miami Beach Bowl, man. Have fun. Play the game and head back to the beach. So, yeah, so... That was crazy, almost as crazy as the way that the NCAA looks at these collegiate athletes. And we had a good chat with our buddy Morgan Campbell about this that I think we're going to play, because I was really intrigued by his thoughts on the issue, Marcus.
Yeah, Morgan is a Northwestern alum. He actually was on the football team at one point as well, and he's also a journalist, so he has a good observation from both sides of the angle on this topic.
Yeah, Northwestern, of course, where... one of the key schools in the All Players United movement from earlier in the year. So we'll talk about that. And, you know, this isn't going to be a segment full of laughs and jokes and funny observations. But, you know, it's not always fun and games. Sometimes we have to talk about serious issues like domestic violence. Sometimes we got to talk about racial issues like what happened in Ferguson or what happened with Eric Garner. You know, and we're not going to shy away from that. You know, Marcus and I think we try to talk about it in the best way we can, as honestly as we can. And, you know, for those that appreciate it, we appreciate you guys. And for those that don't worry, because, you know, in 10 or 15 minutes, we'll be back talking about sports again.
Hit the fast forward button, people.
So, yeah, here's some of our favorite interviews about some of our, I won't say our least favorite subjects, but some serious topics. But we hope you enjoy it. And we'll be back with some more craziness after this.
Welcome back to the Kings of Sport. Marcus here. Nate is stepping out for this interview here, and joined today by a special guest and a good friend of mine, Monique Jones, who is the Baltimore Ravens editor for the Baltimore Sun. And she's joining us today to discuss Ray Rice, who was all in the headlines last week for the fallout from his two-game suspension that was handed out by the NFL. Monique, thank you for joining the Kings of Sport.
Thanks. I'm sorry that I missed Nate. Nate, you're going to miss a great interview here.
Yeah, you know, Nate is he's on that CP time, and we keep it 100. Nate is a no-show. So I don't know if he has a thing against women or the Ravens or what, but he is nowhere to be found. So
we won't hold it against him.
So yeah, the Baltimore training camp is open, and you know, outside of the hoopla in Cleveland, the second biggest, I guess, media attraction has now been Baltimore because of the Ray Rice suspension. What's been the reaction from the two-game suspension from that was handed out last week?
I mean, I think the thing about the Ravens is that this has just been a tumultuous offseason in general, highlighted by the fact that they're, you know, the Ray Rice has been one of the big pillars in the community in terms of activism. He had this anti-bullying campaign that, you know, he would go to elementary schools and rally kids and talk about bullying, and was really kind of a person who was in front of that quite a bit for his time that he's been here. You know, always a big smile on his face and definitely a fan favorite in this area. So for all the things that happened with the Ravens, from winning the Super Bowl to the very next year not making the playoffs for the first time since John Harbaugh became coach in 2008, the last thing this team wanted, the community wanted to see, was one of their fan favorites not only end up on the front page for being arrested for a simple assault at the time, but then on top of that, for a video to come out of him actually doing the act. of, you know, pulling out his now wife out of this elevator and dragging her, and then being approached by security of a casino hotel. No one has seen publicly, we have not seen the video of the initial assault that led to her being passed out, but, you know, obviously casino security saw it, the NFL has seen it, and from all of that and the follow-up with the prosecutor allowing Ray to be admitted into a pretrial diversion program for first-time offenders, the NFL made their decision to suspend him for 2 games, and now he is, the reaction has kind of been that the Ravens got away with something here, because now he could have been up, it could have been 4 games, it could have been 3, and the reaction's been mixed. From the Ravens' perspective, people here have been happy because they feel like he is going to do his time for what he did, and in terms of serving the suspension and losing a $530,000 in wages. But then nationally, it seems to have gotten a bit of a different response. So the fans have kind of here, obviously, have been very supportive, but nationally, the story's been much different.
You mentioned the local response. Monday during an open practice, Ray Rice was cheered by the fans. It sounds like it weren't many boos in the stands. Are you a little bit surprised? In the Baltimore Sun about even just female fans and kids wearing Ray Rice jerseys. Is this sort of what you expected?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, just from, like I said, you know, people have been, in general, people have been supportive. I mean, I do think that there are definitely the voices out there who felt like this was not enough for what happened. But, you know, people have been somewhat supportive. I will say that the crowd response was measured. It wasn't like there was this roaring standing ovation when Ray took the field yesterday. There were 28,000 fans for the team's first open public practice of training camp, which started last week. And it was kind of a measured applause. I mean, either way, it was applause. There definitely wasn't a discernible amount of boos heard, but it wasn't the overwhelming response that you might have seen with some of the other bigger names came on the screen. So I do think fans were aware of the situation and what it might look like to just kind of over-the-top cheer for Ray Rice. I don't think it was to that extreme, but obviously there was support shown for him to the extent that he saluted the crowd when he was shown on the video board. So obviously there was enough support there for him to acknowledge that people were behind him.
And from the national perspective, we heard a loud outcry from the female fan base, especially female NFL fans who were outraged by the 2 games that were handed out. I'm not going to say, were you surprised by this reaction? But did you think that they would play such a vocal role, especially in social media, where, you know, after the Tony Dungy thing subsided, the Nets' hot topic later in the week was Ray Rice and just the response?
No, I'm not surprised. I mean, I think the biggest thing here to remember is that, you know, normally you hear about a domestic assault or domestic violence. You don't see it. You hear about it from purely reading about it. It's he said versus she said. And it doesn't become as prominent of a story because it's just words. It's just somebody's version of what happened. If there's a photo, which we've seen in the past, when there's a photo of the actual harm that's been inflicted on the victim, that tends to have the next level of interest. And then ultimately the video. If there was no video of Ray Rice dragging his then fiance out of an elevator, I don't know that this would have gotten to the extent that it's gotten to. So people saw him, they saw the aftermath, and as a result, I think that has allowed people to have a little bit of an outcry because they saw it, they feel like they saw it happen, and yet nothing in their mind was done to appropriately justify the offense. So I'm not surprised, and I think a lot of people have an opinion on it. And the NFL probably, I don't know that the NFL is expecting the reaction that they received, because for them to put Adolfo Birch out there on ESPN yesterday and have him kind of clarify or give reason turned into a disaster for them in terms of PR because he could not adequately answer the questions on Mike and Mike that you know, people were asking, which is how do you justify this when you have this wide range of suspensions? So I don't know that the NFL was really prepared for the reaction that they received. And from the Ravens' perspective, all they said was, this is appropriate. We think it was fair. You know, he'll serve his time. But, you know, what else are they going to say? You know, a player who's a key part of their offense is only going to be out 2 games. Now, granted, it's a critical 2 games because that Ravens start off with AFC North opponents. But at the same time, he could have been out 3 to 4 games, which is going to have a bigger impact on a 16-game season.
Finally, I did want to touch on real quick before we get out here and get to the ringside wrap in the next segment. The big news from college football over this past week was the union and your boy Kane Coulter, who I've been very impressed with. You know, of course, we knew he was a good player, but just the kind of the leadership that this kid is showing off the field in terms of, you know, being involved with the All Players United movement, and now, you know, leading his team in terms of trying to start a union in college football.
Actually, let me try to patch in someone who might be able to speak on this.
Okay.
All right, so we had a special guest here to talk about this whole Northwestern situation. Morgan Campbell returning to the show, and a former member of the Northwestern Wildcats. What's up, Morgan?
Hey, Morgan! I'm good. This is Man, who do we beat in basketball? Like, we beat Wisconsin this week. We beat
You're beating the man this week? No, you beat Michigan State.
We beat some ranked teams this year in basketball, and now we have, our football players taking this big, big, big historic step. Like, whether or not it even goes anywhere, the step is historic.
What are your thoughts overall on this whole situation with the union?
Well, this is the way the trend has been going the last few years, right? With more and more agitation for the idea of players getting paid or players getting compensated in something beyond scholarships. There's that, you know, and then with the class action suit led by Ed O'Bannon, you know, against the NCAA and EA Sports. So as college football, you know, with the death of the BCS, becomes a bigger and even bigger and even bigger business, and all these conferences start realigning on the basis of business and broadcast rights instead of on the basis of academics or even competition, there's obviously more and more money to go around. It's not going around to the players. I'm sure we've talked about that before. But again, the other side of the debate is getting so much momentum that something like this, you know, had to happen at some point. And, you know, Northwestern is kind of, you know, an ideal place for that to happen because it's a private school, you know, so it's not subject to all. It's a school, you know, with a higher academic standard than a lot of other, you know, football bowl subdivision schools. So again, while every single person on the team, you know, isn't a Rhodes Scholar, you'll find a lot more critical thinkers on that team than you might find someplace else, and guys who can take the broader view of the situation, you know, and apply their critical thinking skills and come to the conclusion that, you know, the system, no matter where you are in this thing, whether you're at Northwestern or Sam Houston State, the system isn't fair, and you know, in a lot of ways, athletes are exploited. So Northwestern student athletes are in an ideal situation to do something about it. And a lot of it, too, is public perception. You know, because they go to Northwestern, like, the general public is going to recognize these guys as smart guys who have thought about this thing. Whereas if they were from Ohio State, Florida State, Texas, you know, they might be portrayed as just a bunch of spoiled, dumb jocks who have a lot and simply want more. But coming from Northwestern, the knee-jerk, the initial reaction is to hear these guys out because you realize academically a lot of them do have something on the ball. So it's not as simple just to dismiss them as dumb and spoiled jocks.
Yeah, I think that's a great point because, you know,
the court battle will be decided, you know, where it's decided. And, you know, we all know the NCAA can lawyer up with the best of them. But I think the public perception battle is where this thing really is making some waves, because for so long, if you brought up the topic of, you know, compensating athletes or, you know, ways to better, you know, accommodate these student athletes, you know, the standard argument would be, oh, you know, they're getting tuition, they're getting free room and board, where they need to be compensated for. But I think now with the Ed O'Bannon case, with what we saw at Grambling and with these Northwestern players coming out, I think that, you know, the argument is changing slowly but surely. And the dynamic is not just to automatically go, you know, what do these kids need money for? You know, because I think something as simple as the scholarship, which all of us understand, you know, following sports, that it's a year-to-year thing. Most people think when you get a scholarship, it's 4 years. And that's not the case at all.
Well, I've never understood the question, you know, why do the players need money? Because if you're going to ask why the players need money, why not ask why the coaches need money? You know, why do the people that run the NCAA, why do you guys need money? Why don't we pay you guys in kind? Why don't I say to Nick Saban, instead of I can't remember off the top of my head how much Nick Saban makes, but let's just say for the sake of this discussion that he makes $5 million a year, why don't I say to Nick Saban, like, listen, we're not going to give you $5 million a year in cash, but we will give you $5 million a year with scholarship room and board to use at your convenience during the season, after the season, after retirement. He would say no. Because the point is, you know, I don't have to convince you guys of this, but it's a commercial venture. You know, football at that level, basketball at that level, and the people involved in a commercial venture and the people making the money who make this commercial venture so lucrative deserve to be paid, period. Period. Doesn't matter what they're getting in kind. Because, again, these transactions that take place between there's the schools, the conferences, and the television network, they're not trading in kind goods, right? Northwestern doesn't say, well, I'll send you 800 textbooks if you guys broadcast our games, or you broadcast our games, or you guys pay us, you know, in office supplies and pens, you know, for the privilege of broadcasting. No, they exchange cash. So I've never really understood that argument, you know, and I've never understood the questioning of why should players get money. You know, the question is, why shouldn't they? If everyone else is getting money, why shouldn't they?
When it comes to a revolution, an unwritten rule is that a lot of people, a lot of individuals, leaders who start revolutions end up getting crushed, and they end up being martyrs as a step in the process to raise awareness and to complete the revolution. Somebody else has to take over. Are you worried that Northwestern could be seen in the annals of history as, well, they were martyrs, they are the guys who started it, but they weren't able to quite finish?
Much like the 2013 football team.
That was Marcus.
And he knows I support Northwestern, so I can say that, right, right, Morgan?
Some of my best friends are Northwestern graduates.
I wear purple at NABJ to support. Come on.
I think, and what I could see is other schools using this as a negative recruiting tool, right? But at the same time, it could be a positive recruiting tool, right? Like, we're leading the fight to get you guys paid. Although I'm not sure you can talk about payment in recruiting, but I could see other schools using it as a negative recruiting tool. In terms of, you know, because it's difficult, again, I don't know what mechanism the NCAA has, you know, to penalize young men for joining a union or joining a group that's affiliated with the union. I don't know what mechanism they have to penalize Northwestern for this. So I don't know. But of course, the NCAA is not afraid to make up rules on the fly.
No, not at all. It's a watchdog commission.
Yeah, so if they all of a sudden outlaw, you know, union membership, and then all of a sudden you have all these Northwestern guys who are on the wrong side of the rule by default, then maybe something can happen, but it's too hard to speculate for me at this point. Again, what I'm looking at is, you know, where this goes from here. Does this spread to other campuses? And at a certain point, and at what point, you know, again, does the NCAA's stranglehold on college athletics loosen? Because the other thing at play here too is that, like, you see how these teams change conferences, right? Like, mm-hmm. Maryland went to the Big Ten. Why? You know, it's a longer travel time, you know, to all of these different schools, but they went to the Big Ten because the Big Ten has better media rights deals, and Maryland can get more money from being part of the Big Ten. You know, games on the Big Ten Network, ABC, ESPN, on down the line. They would be in another conference. But at a certain point, like, and I've had this discussion too with, like, on the old All Balls Don't Bounce podcast with Will and with Bomani. When you look at the economics of college sport, like, these power conferences could get to the point where they don't need the NCAA, right? Like, why do the SEC, Big Ten, ACC, Big 12, why do they need the NCAA? Right? They could very easily create their own college football super league, right? So I find, in these schools, as they change conferences, you know, they're exercising a greater degree of autonomy in making decisions not necessarily what's best for the NCAA, but what's based on what's best for their own financial interest. So, you know, the NCAA's stranglehold over control of college athletics is potentially, you know, being threatened on the player front, but again, also on the conference front. So what I'm waiting to see is what the NCAA's counter moves are, because again, there's much too much money tied up in the NCAA having control over all this. But at the same time, everyone else recognizes too that there's a big pie that they want their piece of. So that's what I'm interested to see, is how the NCAA reacts to this. What are their counter moves going to be to control these players, to keep this movement from spreading? And what are their counter moves going to be, you know, against schools and conferences who at some point might decide that they don't need the NCAA either?
Before we let you go, just a twit boxing question, because we're both watching Victor Ortiz fight for the last time, yes. Hopefully. This is it for Victor, right?
He go.
Is this it for Victor?
It's got to be, right?
Oh, who knows? You know, the thing about Victor is the best thing that ever happened to Victor Ortiz was getting knocked out by Floyd Mayweather the way he did. Right? Is Victor Ortiz on Dancing with the Stars if that fight ends in any other way?
Nope.
Right? If he loses, you don't see Canelo Alvarez on Dancing with the Stars.
Not yet.
You know, getting taken to school over 12 rounds. You don't see Robert Guerrero on Dancing with the Stars. And somehow Victor Ortiz wound up on Dancing with the Stars because he got knocked out like a sucker against Floyd Mayweather. And that should have been his moment to retire, because, you know, he could have, crossed over into that guy who's just famous for being famous. I don't know where he goes from here. I don't know what else he's going to do for a living besides box. I don't know if he can re-enter that sphere of celebrity for celebrity's sake. Something tells me he can't, because he was just fighting on Fox Sports, you know, as opposed to HBO. So this is where Victor Ortiz's boxing career is at. But it's also a reflection of where his profile is.
Friday Night Fights is nuts, man. That's the next stop.
Say that again.
I said Friday Night Fights is the next stop for him.
I think that's where he might. Well, you say that, but I think it's true. It's true. Friday Night Fights, Showbox, where he becomes a gatekeeper, right? Where he fights a guy. He starts fighting guys a cut below Luis Colato. He starts fighting guys. He becomes the guy like Burt Cooper was back in the day, who you fought to see whether or not you were a contender. If you can beat Ortiz, you might be a contender. If you can't beat Ortiz, you're clearly not a contender. I think that's the role he winds up playing, you know, in boxing's ecosystem, because he didn't take full advantage of the celebrity Floyd Mayweather gave him by knocking him into next week.
So basically, he's like a punch out character. Then he's like the dude you got to face before you get the safe code.
He's Piston Honda.
Yeah,
I was gonna say Piston Honda. Piston Honda, you don't have a prayer, but if you can beat Piston Honda, then you have a chance against King Hippo and the rest of them. We know what? Back to Northwestern. Well, I can't, because this is one of these things that, and I know about this because I went to Northwestern, but the other thing, you know, that's really interesting about this to me, and I wonder if Kane Coulter and them and his teammates are, aware of this history, because there is a precedent for athlete activism at Northwestern. If you know the history of that school, then you'll know about the May 3rd, 4th Agreement, which was signed in 1968. It was after a takeover of the student accounts office. Basically, all the black kids on campus, there was only 110 of them.
Wow.
Right? Took over this office, went to administration with this list of demands. You know, one of it was increased, it was an African-American studies department, increased African-American enrollment. I think one of the demand was, keep it at 10%. And a lot of the people at the center of that protest, of the sit-in that led to the May 3rd, 4th Agreement that led to the Department of African American Studies being established, a lot of people at the center of that protest were football players, mainly because it was a numbers game, right? There's only 110 black kids on campus at the time. If the football team has 100 guys, then 50 of them are black, 40 of them are black, whatever it is, a lot of a significant percentage of the student body, black student body at the time, was football players. So a lot of football players involved in the sit-in that led to the May 3rd, 4th Agreement, which led to, some significant changes in the complexion of that campus. So, this isn't the first instance of activism at Northwestern. I'm glad to see it, in a lot of ways, because it's my alma mater. It's a subject, and an issue that's close to my heart. But again, I'm interested to see where it goes, and I'm interested to see what the NCAA's counter moves are, because they're not just going to sit back and let the free laborers start grabbing at the cash piles. There will be, consequences.
For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, Jesus Christ the Lord. Ye shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host praising God, and saying, Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men. That's what Christmas is all about, Charlie Brown.
We are back on the Kings of Sport Holiday Special. It's the best of 2014. Merry Christmas to everybody out there listening in Kings of Sport Nation. Marks and Nate, we are back. And, of course, the podcast is powered by our friends over at Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com is your one-stop spot for the latest and greatest in sports, pro wrestling, entertainment, whatever you need, they got it there. They're your one-stop spot for your pop culture fix. And Marcus, I don't know if you're a big fan of Christmas plays.
There was a Christmas play in the Saved by the Bell Tea Party Special.
Okay, so I'm assuming that you're well-versed in Christmas plays. So you've seen that one and at least the one in the Charlie Brown Christmas Special.
Yes.
So you've seen at least two.
How did Charlie Brown not make the list? No one's
I
list.
Mean, it's in my top five, but it's not beating Jingle All the Way. I mean, I played the clip at the top of the segment, though, so that's a little shout out to Charlie Brown.
Shout out to Charlie.
Yeah. But we have a play at Place to Be Nation that it might be out now. I know they were going to drop it on Christmas Day, so you're probably going to listen to it now, or not now, obviously, because you still got like 15, 20 minutes of this show left, at least. But when you get some time over this holiday season, check out the Place to Be Nation Christmas play featuring yours truly, Marcus. This is going to be something I think you'll enjoy. Kevin Kelly, formerly of the WWF, is the moderator. He's the narrator of this Christmas play.
Hello. How are you acting to mention his current job? He's not living off his WWF days. What does the man do currently?
He's doing a little mom and pop thing called Ring of Honor.
Super kick. Come on.
But yeah, Kevin Kelly is part of the Place to Be family. He's got a podcast as well as his hosting duties on Ring of Honor. But Kevin Kelly was the narrator. The various hosts of the Place to Be Nation podcast were involved. Those that could attend were involved. And I got to play a character that I think you'll get a kick out of, Marcus. I was Santa Claus.
Wait a second. Santa's white, right?
I was Santa Claus. The one time I finally get to play a character on the radio, Place to Be Nation radio play, and I'm Santa Claus. I'm a black Santa Claus, which made me a literal magical Negro.
Wow.
I just come down from the heavens and solve poor white boys' problems with my wise North Pole wisdom.
Wow, that's...
Like, I didn't know whether to be offended or to be honored, because, I mean...
That's an honor.
Morgan Freeman made a career out of playing magical Negroes.
He still does.
He was God. He was, what's my man in Shawshank? I forget his name.
I haven't seen it.
You never seen Shawshank?
No. I did see the later movie, however, featuring Morgan Freeman. Saw that on Saturday.
Was he playing a magical Negro in that?
He was playing like some type of, not godlike figure, but something that you would associate Morgan Freeman with.
Yeah, so basically, yeah, the Morgan Freeman magical Negro character. But yeah, Shawshank was great. Then, talk amongst yourself for a second, Marcus. This is going to bother me until 2015, so I got to look this up.
So in other news... it's sunny in Los Angeles. It's almost Christmas time.
How's that whole Guardians of Peace thing working out? You still safe?
Did you see the latest update on that?
No, I didn't.
Now Sony's releasing the films in certain theaters. Yeah.
Red Redding. That's who he was. Morgan Freeman was Red Redding. And, of course, your boy Tim Robbins played Andy Dufresne. The first time I met Andy Dufresne. Let me tell you what, Marcus. You either get busy living or you get busy dying.
Yeah, no Shawshank for me.
Not a bad Morgan Freeman right there. It's like, I think my Morgan Freeman is better than my
Can you do a Joe Clark, though?
They used to call me Joe Clark. Now they can call me Batman. Jump! Why don't you jump? I love Lean On Me.
Sam's?
Mr. Clark, they killed Kid Ray!
Mr. Clark! Alright, it's my contribution to me doing the pregnant girl.
Homegirl from Carmen Sandiego was in that too.
Yes, she was like the corrupt. What do you call it? She was on the side
like
of the
PTA board, but then yeah, she wanted to get rid of Joe Clark, so she teamed up with the school board and the mayor or whatever. Yeah, she's dead now. So rest in peace, Lynn Thigpen.
Damn, she's dead.
Yeah, she died a couple years ago. She's been in a lot of things. She was in you remember that Samuel Jackson remake of Shaft?
Mm-hmm.
She was the mother in that one that her son died. And so she basically pulled the old black guy from New Jack City and, spoiler alert, shot the guy that killed her son at the end of the movie on the courtroom steps.
Oh. But you know who's still alive, right?
Who?
The grandmother from Ghost Rider.
Grandmother from Ghost Rider?
Yeah.
I remember Ghost Rider. I don't remember the grandmother.
Jamal's grandmother. I'm trying to think of her name.
Like, really, the only person I remember from Ghost Rider was that dude that was a little too old to be hanging out with them kids. Like he was a villain sometimes, and then sometimes he was a friend. You know what I'm talking about? Like Manny.
Manny? Yeah. Yeah.
Like, he was just like, the kids was like 15, 16. Manny was like 24. Like, this is, you a little too old, dog, to be hanging out with these kids. I don't care if they have supernatural powers.
Marcella Lowry is her real name. Also, really? The Colonial Pen commercials, you haven't seen her in that?
She's also I know her.
Yeah. She's also City Guys.
To me, she's Jeffrey's mother on the Cosby Show.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was on that show.
Yeah.
Featuring.
Featuring Claire Huxtable, a.k.a. Felicia Rashad,
and
who was our unanimous winner for Mother of the Year.
Who was she married to?
Ahmad Rashad, obviously.
Who is she married to on the TV show?
We're not going to get into all that.
No.
No. Yeah, she had a recurring role on The Cosby Show as Francine Thibodeau, the mother of Elvin Thibodeau, portrayed by Jeffrey Owens.
Hey, Elvin. What a waste that dude was.
Oh, do you watch It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia?
No.
That might have been my favorite cameo they've ever done when they had Faison Love booking like an Eagles tryout camp, and then the gang went to try out for the Eagles, and he's like, don't worry, we're going to work hard, we're going to train hard, and Donovan McNabb is coming out here to talk to you. So they went through the whole day of practice. Donovan McNabb finally comes out, the car pulls up, and the guy that gets out is Jeffrey Owens, Elvin from The Cosby Show, and he's like, hey, everybody, I'm Donovan McNabb, and if you want to be a champion, fuel up at McDonald's. Like, he's basically pimping Faison Love's McDonald's that he owns.
Uh-huh.
And somebody in the crowd's like, that's not Donovan McNabb. And the other guy's like, yeah, he kind of looks like the Sandra's husband from The Cosby Show. So then he just hops back in his car, like, that's it. See you guys later. But, yeah, so that was probably his greatest cameo. But, We've got a little bit long-winded in this intro.
We're way off track.
We're way, way off track. But I guess it's kind of fitting because right now we're going to get into some of the crazy tangents we dive into. Segment 4, those of you that are new to the program, is our repository for ratchetness where we talk about the craziness in the world of sports and pop culture. And this year, we had some interesting conversations, Marcus. Not only did I learn that you believe that Joan Rivers was overrated. That was where you and I had some beef this year. But we learned some things about you personally. Not just that you like romantic comedies, but we learned about the true secret behind your good hair. And I'm not even playing, folks. The time Marcus was at Neverland Ranch.
Pre good hair, by the way. This was like bad hair, Marcus.
Yeah, because once you left Neverland Ranch, you had a nice little perm.
Yeah, Mike cut it up.
You look so good now, Marcus. That's a man in the mirror you can appreciate. I think We'll throw to our segment for wackiness and craziness, Marcus. And then I think we'll come back and say goodbye to the people.
All right, that works.
That'll work. All right, so here's some crazy segment four discussions, again, featuring Joan Rivers, Michael Jackson, and who knows what else, maybe even a clown and baby. Welcome back. For those that don't know, Marcus did pop the question to his boo last week down in Orlando, Florida. And unlike Chris Saban on TNA Impact last week, there was actually a ring in the box.
And she said yes. So congratulations, brother. How was your week?
Thanks, man. It was a good week. I had fun at Disney World. My first real time going. I've been twice before, but both times were sort of only for a few hours. So, first road trip to really check out the whole park. We're both big Disney people since we live out here with Disneyland and stuff. So it was a good chance to check out Disney World and not work for a few days, which is always a good thing.
I'm sure you had a lovely time out enjoying all the rides and having the romantic dinners with your girl. But what I and everybody else wants to know is, did you go see Captain EO?
Oh, of course. Oh, yes. we've usually always seen when we're at the parks at Disneyland. So, yeah, we had to see it at Disney World. And it didn't disappoint. You know, it's the same 15-minute show that it always is. But just the fact that they had so much star power in terms of Coppola, MJ, and George Lucas on that project in the 80s, and the fact that this was really probably the first big 3D project that the world was introduced to, it's still fascinating to watch 30 years later.
Yeah, the crazy thing is they actually canceled it. Like, I remember going to Disneyland probably in the early 90s, and Captain EO was just this ridiculous experience. Like you said, it's 15 minutes, and, you know, you got the space adventure and Michael Jackson and the songs. It's just another part of me. And it's just a great thing. And then I guess in the late 90s, they cut it from the parks. And then I guess after MJ's death, they brought it back. Because, well,
you know, why
they never wanted to turn down a book.
Well, you know why they had to cut it, right?
I mean, why would you not want little children to see Michael Jackson in a spangly costume singing to them?
Mm-hmm. I've told you the Netherlands story, right?
No, you haven't.
Oh, I've been to the ranch.
You've been to Neverland Ranch?
Yeah.
How old were you when you went to Neverland Ranch?
I was a teenager. I was probably like...
Did you sleep in Michael's room that night? Did you have some Jesus juice?
I did not. I was like 12 or 13, maybe. I'll tell the story real quick. So, growing up, my neighbor worked security for Michael Jackson. She was a former LAPD cop, and she ended up being private security for MJ. So one day, Michael had a friends and family weekend for people who worked with him at the ranch. And our neighbor invited us to go. So the entire family went. Drove up. It's a little north of Santa Barbara in California. And before you get to the ranch, there was like security who was stopping every car to make sure you didn't have any cameras in the car, because they wanted no pictures, video, etc. And this is long before the cell phone era in terms of cameras. So once we passed through security and stuff, we got to the ranch, and the best way to describe it was it felt like a mini amusement park. He had a train that ran through the entire ranch. He had a movie theater. He had his own private zoo. He had this arcade. He had, along the train stop, you could ride the train, and one of the stops was literally at this candy store, and it was like all the candy you could eat for free. It was pretty insane. And no,
everything a child would want.
It, pretty much. And no, there was no Michael Jackson sighting, so we were trying to
look. I was going
to
say, was MJ there?
He was not there. Well, they say he was not there. He could have been in the window looking, stoping, just scouting.
I like that light-skinned one right there.
Yeah. But yeah, it's one of those.
Did you see Bubbles? Was Bubbles on the ranch?
I do not remember seeing Bubbles. No, I did. I remember seeing animals, but I don't remember if he was there in particular.
Oh, wow! So I never thought in the history of this podcast we would have a story where one of the kings, as a young prepubescent boy, would have an adventure in Neverland.
Yeah, it was. It's one of those memories / stories that, you know, every now and then it'll come up when people talk about Michael Jackson, and I'll say, "Oh yeah, I've been to the ranch," and then people usually have the same response of, "How old were you?" And was Michael there? Yeah.
Marcus, don't you want to climb trees?
No.
Oh, rest in peace, Michael. Well, there's no way to segue into our first story off of Michael Jackson.
Oh, yeah. No. All right.
You gonna learn today.
Yo, this is Gary Washburn from the Boston Globe, and you're listening to King of Sport. Keep tuning in. You know you're gonna get something good.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
And welcome back to the Kings of Sport. Ready to close up shop for another week. I'm back. I had to take a break from the last segment. I didn't want to be a part of you guys bashing TNA. I did not want to co-sign that.
Man, come on. You should be used to it by now.
No, it's always fun TNA bashing, man. You got to try it.
It's the best.
No, like Wale said, I'm trying to live respectful and have principles.
If you had principles, you wouldn't watch TNA.
Hey, I do it so others don't have to.
Like us, yeah, thank you. So,
whether it's reviewing Impact or you know, I don't even know if I'm going back on reviewing Impact. That's still up in the air.
Yeah, I mean, I told you about what they were saying about you in New Orleans, so I don't know if you should go back. You know, John and Way were, I don't know.
It's like the Shield. We were feuding, then we were friends again, but ultimately it leads back to a feud.
Yeah.
So we'll see about reviewing Impact, but you can check out my weekly Impact review, which is, I used to do a regular recap, which took way too much time. So now I've kind of got a new format, and people seem to dig it, but you can find it on Place to Be Nation, placetobenation.com. So I will be talking about TNA without the haters like Marcus and Alfred from the Dirty Sheets, as Willow would say.
The haters. Just
did you at least listen to that promo?
I listened to Impact review of Impact. Yeah, I heard.
Yes, that was, yeah, Jeff Hardy, man. Jeff Hardy.
Don't do drugs, boys and girls. Not that he's on drugs, but don't do it in general.
No, and
that's like I'm on drugs when I'm watching those promos.
Yeah, now. And that's a perfect segue to head into segment four, where we talk about all the ratchetness from the past week in sports, entertainment, and pop culture in general, because. From one person that had a cut promos like he was on drugs to a crowd that was most likely under the influence. This time last week, I was having one of the craziest nights of my life watching Outkast reunite at Coachella, watching it live on YouTube and enjoying the conversation and the camaraderie on Twitter. And it was everything that you would hope it would be. It was the hits, it was the deep cuts for the true fans, it was tension, both on stage and off stage, it was, you know, friendship that you could see palpably between Andre and Big Boy, it was kind of everything that is Outkast encapsulated and rolled up into one. I know Marcus saw at least a little bit of this set.
An hour or so, yeah.
Yeah, I think they went 90 minutes, a little bit longer than that maybe. Alfred, did you get a chance to check it out?
No, I missed it for the most part, but, you know, I'll go back and watch it. And then hear what you guys have to say about it, obviously.
Yeah, so I'll get into my thoughts in a second, but what were your initial thoughts about the reunion, Brother Marcus?
The first thing that popped in my head was, wow, I forgot how many hits Outkast has.
Yes.
The second thing...
Let's rephrase that. How many good songs Outkast has, because as we'll see later on, apparently they only have three hits.
According
to the crowd.
My second thought was, wow, they must smell, because they're both dressed in these outfits that were not meant for the desert weather.
No.
Including Andre, who's dressed in a hoodie and overalls with a like Mexico hat, which was the weirdest hat ever. It was a Team Mexico hat, and I was so confused and enthralled by the hat. And then the third thing was Future sucks, and why is Future on stage? And that's when I got tired and fell asleep, because why is Future out there in the middle of the show? So yeah, that's when I lost interest.
Yeah, I understand Future's like on the label or whatever, but give him one song.
Yeah, not
don't
two
give
or three,
him like yeah. He had like a little mini concert inside the Outkast concert, which I think, you know, turned a lot of people off. I will say that I agree with Marcus. Like when you see Outkast, you know, go for 90 minutes, it's like they had so many good songs from, you know, the five or six albums that they put out, and it's like, you know, Fresh and So Clean, Crumbling Herb, Hootie Who, Two Dope Boys in a Cadillac, Elevators, It's like, damn, they have so many songs. And it was funny on Twitter. Somebody's like, man, if they play this song, I'm going to lose my mind. Next thing you know, they played it. If they play this song, I'm going to lose my mind. Man, they played it. And I'm sitting there. I'm like, man, if they play Spody Odie Dopalicious, a.k.a. Damn, Damn, Damn James, I'm going to go crazy. Next thing I know, you hear that trumpet. Damn, Damn, Damn James. I'm like, man. So, yeah, I think you got to appreciate the legacy that they had, you know, with the songs. The band was tight. Some of the special guests worked. I think Janelle Monae worked. But
and Future, Sleepy Brown.
Sleepy Brown, yeah. Sleepy
always
Brown.
Always worked.
Yeah, but Future, if they would have kept it to that one song that all three of them did together, that would have been cool. But the Future concert didn't work for me.
How many songs did they do with Future?
Future did like four songs. And,
oh, my God.
And it was Future songs. It was Future songs. It wasn't like it was an Outkast. I mean,
right, yeah. They were all Future songs. Like, three of them were just straight Future. And then there was one with the three of them, which was like actually halfway decent because it was Outkast. And it was new. Yeah.
So Outkast was relegated to the hype in?
Basically.
Yeah, for 10 minutes or so.
Yeah. The other thing I think about this set from a perspective of Outkast is, it seemed toned down, like you didn't see like the dramatic staging. Like they had that one big box that looked like Magneto's prison from the X-Men, and that was what they basically performed in the entire night.
Well, I mean, they explained the story, which made sense once Big Boy explained why that was the setup. But yeah, you're right.
But yeah, you expect, you know, Outkast, first time we've seen him perform, you know, in what, a decade?
Yeah.
Been that long?
At least 7 or 8 years.
Yeah, I would say seven.
Yeah, it hasn't been 10 years yet, but
because they really didn't do a full tour for Speaker Box to Love Below.
No, they did not. And then Big Boy started doing solo stuff, and yeah.
Because like I think this was the first time that Andre 3000 actually performed some of the songs from the Love Below, which was cool if not shaky, because. You know, it was cool. Like I said, his voice wasn't quite there, but I mean, he probably hadn't even touched these songs for at least 5 years. And for him to, you know, go out there and perform them for the first time in front of the audience, which I will get to in a second, I thought was pretty cool. I think they could have done a lot better job in terms of weaving the solo stuff in throughout the concert, because it did get to a point where the first 45 minutes was just hot because it was just Outkast. Hit after hit after hit after hit. Then we got Big Boy for like 20 minutes, and then Andre for like 15 minutes, and that's where the show started to drag until they brought it back with they came back with Roses, which the crowd went crazy for.
Yeah, you've got to know your crowd, and not only your crowd, you've got to know generally the consensus of a crowd.
Well, you've got to know this crowd. You got to know this Coachella crowd. This ain't Decatur or Detroit. This is a specific crowd that I don't think Outkast was ready for.
Well, I think Outkast as a brand, as a duo, if they would have done the whole concert together and performed the general lowest common denominator hits, it would have been amazing. But for it to drag, of course, I'm not surprised at all that it would drag if they just kind of split off and do their own thing, because that wasn't nearly as popular as them getting together and doing songs together. You know, remember Roses was the one song that they had that double album, and it was Andre and then Big Boy, and then they came together for Roses, and that was a huge hit. So, and there's a reason behind that, is because people like Outkast more than the single components.
Yeah, let me tell you about this crowd. This crowd, they were hot, of course, at the beginning, and I think that it was a weird mix, because at the beginning, from the reports, like the hardcore Outkast fans were kind of towards the middle of the back, and just kind of your regular Coachella goer was at the front, and they popped big for, you know, Roses, Bombs Over Baghdad, Rosa Parks, and The Way You Move, and they were really, like, you could tell, they were just waiting for Hey Y'all all night long. And the crowd at points, granted, it was late, like, they were the last act of the night, and the crowd at points seemed a little bit drained from that girl talk, that riveting girl talk performance before Outkast came out.
Hey, don't go after girl talk.
Oh, so you're gonna defend girl talk?
Yes, I'm gonna defend girl talk. Who had a hyper crowd? Girl talk or Outkast?
You defend girl talk and Barry Scandal? Where? What? Who are you, Marcus?
Who had the better crowd? Girl talk. Thank you.
Girl talk knew their audience. Outkast did not. Hey. Obviously, and because you could see at various times during the night,
Big Boy be like, y'all still with us? And they'd be like, yay. Or Andre 2000 be like, y'all still breathing? Y'all still ready for some more hits?
Maybe, yeah. Maybe Goto was the problem. Maybe it was just a natural.
Girl Talk burned out the crowd.
Yeah, I mean, might have. Well, I think just the sun and heat in general burns out the crowd, you know, with.
And the drugs.
And the drugs too, yeah.
Allegedly. I think it says more about the crowd than Girl Talk when Girl Talk is more over than OutKast.
It's. You know, I think in general, those DJ type acts are more over at Coachella than.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I wouldn't use the crowd as an indication to how OutKast performed or OutKast as an act.
Yeah, I just think they need to be. If you look at Twitter, it was like, you know, the kind of the hip hop kind of consensus was, although it was shaky, like it was a really cool performance.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that, you know, if they had done this concert, like I said, in Atlanta or, you know, in Baltimore, D.C., you know, L.A. even, you know, in any more, I won't say urban environment because OutKast isn't just limited to an urban environment, but a more hip-hop environment. If they were in a more, you know, culturally diverse environment, I think that, you know, they would have gotten over a little bit more.
Listen, if you were to take this performance and put it at Summer Jam, it'd be amazing. But
yeah.
You know, Coachella is in Summer Jam, and it made sense probably from a financial aspect to, if you're going to do this tour circuit, to start with Coachella. But, you know, this is one of the drawbacks of doing shows like Coachella. What else did they sign up for this year? Lollapalooza, I believe.
Yeah. I think it's like, it's a nice little summer loop. So
maybe Bonnaroo's, all those type of tours there, you're talking about such a wide range of audience that it's going to be tough to really draw them in, even though that white people love their hip hop, but sometimes, you know.
And the funniest thing to me, Alfred, you said you didn't see it, but you got to go back and watch this. They waited until like the last three or four songs of this 90-minute set to get to Hey Ya, which is what most of the crowd was there to hear. And
I hate that Andre, song.
It's like a song that if you're an OutKast fan, like when you first heard it, you're like, oh, that's pretty cool. But now it's like, ugh.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's the same way OutKast feels about the song,
yeah,
especially
I'm,
Andre.
Yeah.
So when they finally got to Hey Ya, Andre 3000 counts it down, you know, one, two, three, turns his back to the crowd and does the entire first verse of Hey Ya with his back facing the crowd. Miles Davis that did the same thing to one of those festival crowds back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically pulled a Miles Davis and because I think he was sick of the crowd, and the crowd, I'm not going to say they were sick of him, but they just really weren't that into him. And you could tell the tension between the two guys, between Andre and the crowd, and Big Boy was kind of the one trying to smooth things over as the kind of intermediate guy, but Andre was done with that crowd, man, and he turned his back to me. I'm like, this is probably the greatest thing I've ever seen at a live concert.
Well, it sounds like that was a microcosm of the group OutKast performing itself, and that they waited too long to do the Hey Ya song, so by the time they got there, it wasn't as hot as it should have been. And I think they waited too long to do a reunion, to where right now we are just getting to this new generation of music where OutKast, I wouldn't say they're antiquated, but they definitely aren't what we are used to and accustomed to today. So I think they might have waited too long for a reunion.
I don't know. I think, you know, like this crowd is like Marcus is saying, is not going to be the litmus test for OutKast. I think, you know, if you put this OutKast performance in front of, let's say, a Drake crowd or a Lil Wayne crowd, I think they could still get that crowd. They could win that crowd over. Yeah. I think the person that was probably feeling the worst about the show was one man that flew out to Coachella, waited all day, listened to all the acts, Lord and Girl Talk and somebody, like, who else was at Coachella that first day?
On Friday?
Yeah.
It was
like 30 or 40 different groups, because I remember, like, reading the lineup on YouTube. But this
was not, Nas was on Saturday,
Nas
right?
was Saturday.
Yeah, Nas was Saturday.
Motorhead was Sunday. Friday was, you mentioned Lord. Here we go. Broken Bells, Girl Talk, Ellie Goulding, Nico Case. Yeah, you named all the big ones.
Yeah, so he had to basically sit through like 15, 20 acts, waiting all day backstage, probably drinking water and trying to stay hydrated, because you got to stay hydrated. Shout out to Mr. Throwback Thursday. And finally, at the very end, Outkast is like, we know y'all been waiting for this. We want to bring our homeboy out to the stage. And I got excited because I knew who it was going to be. Because these two, they actually had some beef. And I guess they smoothed everything out because he's with him on this summer tour. And I was like, okay, this festival tour, like, it's going to be hot. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the stage, Killer Mike. Killer Mike comes out, big ovation, because you know they're about to do the whole world. Next thing you know, Mr. Coachella in the back. I'm sorry, guys. Time's up. And wow. You just see the deflated look in Killer Mike's face. And Big Boy, of course, the consummate hype man, the consummate professional. He's like, come on, Coachella. Y'all know y'all want to hear one more song? Who want to hear the whole world? And they're like, yeah, we want to hear the whole world. First time the crowd has really been excited in over 30 minutes, probably. And they're like, okay, we're going to do the whole world, Mr. Coachella in the back. Yeah, that's a hard 90 minute, guys. It's not flexible. We got to shut it down. And so they shut it down, and Andre 3000 just looks up, and he's like, man, we brought our homeboy out here, and y'all ain't going to let him do the song? To be fair, if y'all didn't let Future do three songs, Killer Mike could have done the song, but that's neither here nor there. But, yeah, so Killer Mike came all the way out there, and they were like, well, hell, y'all give it up for Killer Mike for flying out here. We'll see y'all next time. That was how the show ended.
She's done the song.
Yeah, this all stems from when Paul McCartney did his set in 2009. This was when curfew was 12 o'clock, and he went past curfew. And City of India has a strict curfew that it's $1,000 for every minute the show goes past curfew. Wow. So the McCartney thing.
Let's say whole world is 4 minutes long. Y'all, you telling me Coachella can't pay $4,000, man, for the whole world, all the money they made off of these tickets?
Well, I mean, they got the curfew pushed back to 1, so I don't think they're trying to, you know, run their luck by fucking things up for a 4 minute song. But that they can do next Saturday or next Friday. So, you know, that's what happens. So,
you definitely owe it to yourself to check it out, Alfred. Overall, I would give the concert, I'd say just in terms of the reunion and the guys getting back together, I'd say it was a solid B. I think that, you know, you could tell there was some rust, but like I said, a lot of these songs, they probably haven't even thought about in 5 or 6, maybe even 7 or 8 years. And so I think for the first go round, it was a pretty solid show. They definitely need to tighten things up in terms of the timing, and Future should only get one song, and, you know, you can't have an Outkast show without Killer Mike. Like, they did Kryptonite, and they didn't even bring Killer Mike out for his verse on Kryptonite. Wow. When Big Boy did his. But that's, I think the thing you realize is Outkast, as much as they've been praised and awarded and things of that nature, I think you forget, like, what a great run of songs these dudes had, both collectively and as individuals.
Sorry, one correction. It's $20,000 for the first 5 minutes, and then $1,000 each minute after that.
Oh, that's a big difference. Yeah, yeah. Whole world ain't worth that much.
Yeah.
Yeah, $4,000 is different than $20. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Killer Mike, go home.
5 times, a little bit.
So yeah, that was Outkast to Coachella. Yeah, those are my thoughts overall. What did you think, Marcus?
Overall, I thought it was awkward at times, which sums up Outkast as a whole. I'm curious to see what happens tonight with their performance, how that
did they interest
out.
You if they come out to closer to your neck of the woods, did they interest you in buying a ticket?
I'm at the point in my life that I'm really not on the concert scene unless I can get a seat. I don't like standing at shows now, especially shows with that crowd. I couldn't imagine doing a Coachella. I would just freak out. If they're playing at a stable center, then yeah, I'd be interested in going. But if they're doing like the festival thing, no, it wouldn't matter. Yeah, it wouldn't matter who's performing.
Because I just googled the performance as you guys were talking about it, and the word awkward comes up a lot. That's like
yes, this was the Chris Bosh of reunion concert.
Yeah.
it was effective, but it was awkward. Oh, speaking of awkward, let's go from one Andre that people probably thought was a dick on stage to another Andre that
may not have a dick on stage? Big Nasty?
Yes, well, rapper Andre Johnson severed his penis and jumped from the Los Angeles apartment building early Wednesday, according to a police report. Johnson was seriously injured, but he survived the fall from the second level of the building in North Hollywood. Los Angeles Police Sergeant William Mann said Johnson, along with his recovered penis, was taken to Cedars-Sinai Medical Center when he's being treated. And details about what triggered the incident are currently not available, but he has some type of notoriety because he's a member of the group Nordstar, which unfortunately is in my neck of the woods in Long Beach, California. And that hip-hop group was part of the Wu-Tang Clan family. Now, moments after this report came out, Wu-Tang on their blog issued a picture of Johnson crossed out and said quite plainly, exclusive, not affiliated to the Wu-Tang brand, with the Wu-Tang Clan, Andre Johnson. So they're saying that they are disavowing any type of affiliation with this rapper, Andre Johnson, not the Houston, Texas football player, with rapper Andre Johnson. And I mean, Nate, I know this is what you wanted to come back for. So what Andre Johnson without a dick?
Yes, yes. When I was leaving, I was like, you know what? I can't talk TNA, but I got to talk Outkast and this rapper with no penis. Now that's Andre Johnson. Yeah, first of all, if this was an apparent suicide attempt, like they're speculating, you know, that's you know, get some help, dude. You know, we've talked about this before, you know, the mind is, something that you don't play with. Get some help, talk to somebody. But first of all, I got to give this man credit because he jumped off the building after he cut off his penis.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but if my penis somehow gets detached from my body, I'm probably going to stay in that spot until it comes back. I'm not going Jackie Chan and jumping off the side of a building. I'm not going Iron Man, Captain America, Winter Soldier, and doing a backflip off a building with no penis.
A backflip, huh?
In my story now, like in the picture in my head.
He's an acrobat now.
Yeah, he's doing like Black Panther, Spider-Man, just real acrobatic moves. With no penis.
By the way, I know the perfect song to close the show with this week. Do you know the detachable penis song?
No.
No. I do now.
It's a rock song. If you
is it by Girl Talk?
No, it's by King Missile. We'll add it at the end of the show. It's called Detachable Penis.
I can't wait for that. That is very fitting for Andre Johnson. I mean, what's up with Wu-Tang? I mean, just disavowing. This guy was clearly a member of the family, and this is not how family treats each other. I think part of the general code of being family is that if somebody chops off their dick, you got to be there for them. I mean, what else is family around for?
Wu-Tang's got $1 million CD to sell. Just one. They got to find the right person to buy that CD. They ain't got time for Andre Johnson and his Johnson.
Is the detachable penis song going to be on that CD?
It'll be a remix. And his nickname was Christ Bearer. I'm just reading this now. Like this, I've never heard. Have you heard that group before? Because I've never heard any of their tracks.
No, until now.
Nordstar. Nordstar. Yeah. This is. We've had some crazy stories in segment four, but this one, how? You can't do that in a state of, like, this has to be a cracky tale, because I don't think you could do this if you're not on some type of substance.
Yeah. I mean, maybe he's just mentally unstable. I mean,
I have dealt with depression before. I have dealt with some mental issues, and then I've worked through them, and never once in the pit of my despair did I ever think, you know what, I'm gonna grab this butter knife and chop off my penis. Like, I think you got to be outside, like, because that's just a natural man fight or flight survival instinct implanted in our DNA from the caveman days. You protect that zone at all costs. So I think he had to be on some dust, on some crack, on something that put him out of his own mind, because I can't see anybody. Like, I don't care if you're the craziest man in the world, Rob Ford is not cutting off his penis.
I think his numbers would go up if he cut off his penis. He's going wrong. He did launch his Arrow campaign, and I'm very, very jealous that I don't get to vote for him.
Yeah.
We have Andre Johnson was included on the soundtrack from 2004 on Blade Trinity. So
really?
Yeah, so he's got some kind of notoriety. Maybe he used that blade to, you know.
Oh, to do that was a good soundtrack too. RZA produced that.
Yes.
Now I got to go back and check it out because yeah. But yeah, I mean Wu Tang. I mean, are any of their satellite groups still relevant?
Is Wu Tang relevant?
I think Wu Tang is relevant just for the name and just for
the brand that, is relevant. That I don't think the artist.
First out $1 million album.
Yeah, the brand is relevant. But in terms of
the music, the actual, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. But the brand is relevant. But I'm talking about like you know all the side splinter groups. Like to me, I never got into any of the splinter Wu Tang groups outside of you know like the Gravediggers because they were so different. But other than Gravediggers, I never really, you know, they just seemed to be, I'm not saying they were terrible, but, you know, I got Wu-Tang to listen to. And this is when Wu-Tang was still putting out records. Why do I need to go and listen to, you know, the JB team?
It's always tough because they cast such a big shadow. You see that with a lot of big-time artists, even ones that are relevant when they're trying to bring on somebody. It's like 50 Cent and Tony Ayo. I remember when everything 50 Cent touched was gold and G-Unit and whatnot, but then he tried to put Tony Ayo on it.
Is your brother backing him? What is your brother doing?
Is somebody making a smoothie?
Somebody is chopping off their penis with a lawnmower, I believe.
Oh, that's outside. Oh, okay.
Oh, that looks
good. That would be... Yeah, actually, I hate to say it, but that would probably be the least painful way.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Like one of those, like the little, the handheld ones with the little, the, you know what I'm talking about? The strips.
Yeah.
And they spin like super fast. Yeah. Because there's no sawing, there's no chopping. Like it's just swoop.
Whatever there was a logical way to do that.
Like Yamaguchi, it's not Val Venus and Yamaguchi sign. A chopping, chopping your pee pee.
Chopping your pee pee.
Oh, man. like I used to be that's how the state of black male tennis has deteriorated, which is a funny thing in and of itself to say. Like James Blake and Maya Washington, like them dudes I used to follow religiously, and it's like I didn't know Donald Young was even a thing, but I guess he's not that big of a thing.
Yeah, he's you know never been that great, but you always, you know, especially the first day of a tournament, you always look for the black faces, and you're like, oh, okay, and then after day one.
Whatever happened to homegirl, is she still around? Dr. J's daughter, or stepdaughter. Or
oh, Alexandra Stevenson.
Yeah, is she still around?
I don't think so. Let's see. Wow, no, she's 33. She's got to be done. By the way, if you haven't heard the story about how she was conceived, you should probably Google. Let's see if I can find it. Google Dr. J and braces, and you will get the infamous Dr. J story of how Alexandra was conceived. Do you know the story?
I do not know the story, Mark.
Oh, even better.
I will have to look this up.
So, I'll just tell you now.
Okay,
great story.
Okay.
So, Dr. J had this book, I believe it was 2013, and so this is from the book, she's talking about the woman, the mother of this child, Samantha Stevenson. So, she becomes someone who helps me unwind. If I'm feeling high strung or stressed, I can drive over and spend a relaxing evening that might even include oral sex, Irving writes. I can only remember one time that we actually had intercourse, and that was because she had just gotten this new orthodontist to straighten her teeth with wire and gleaming metal bristling in her mouth. Oral sets was not an option. So because this woman couldn't pleasure Dr. J with her mouth, she got pregnant and had a daughter.
Oh.
So let this be a lesson, kids, that just one time you can slip up and have a kid.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, I'm looking at her Wikipedia. Apparently she's still active, but she's not a big deal anymore. She's only 33 though. And apparently she ain't got no kids or a man, so next time you see her, Marcus, she's out there. How about your boy?
You would be starred for life too if you realize you were conceived because your mother decided not to suck off your jump off that one night, and then boom, I'm born. Hey, come on, she's got daddy issues, father. I'm sure she's got a bunch of issues dealing with.
Oh, see, all that is knowledge, man. You got to know your enemy. You got to know your target.
I just hope that he at least shared the story of her before the book came out, because that'd be tough if you read about that story without any heads up.
I'd just be like, look here, girl, the only braces we need is our love. Boom. Game, set, and match.
Yeah.
Advantage, Nate. And this is probably why I'm single. Oh, and this is also why this is proof that tonight's game wasn't that exciting, because we just spent like the last 10 minutes talking about tennis and black people in tennis more specifically.
Yeah, that's real niche.
So I think we're done with football for this week, Marcus, but I am interested in discussing a topic that we talked about right minutes before we got on tonight on Skype, and you expressed some strong feelings, and that made me want to talk about this even more. So for those that do not know out there, comedian Joan Rivers passed away. I believe she was 81, following surgical complications. And, you know, it's a bit like, this has been a bad summer for comedy. First Robin Williams and now Joan Rivers. And as a fan of comedy, as a student of the game, somebody that at one time wanted to be a stand-up comic, I got respect for Joan Rivers. But from what you're saying, Marcus, you don't quite feel the same way.
Listen, here's my whole thing, and this is going to be the rant for this podcast. Rest in peace, Joan. I'm sure she was great in her heyday. I know she was a real pioneer for female comedians, but let's not pretend she was god-awful at what she was doing the last 10 years or so on the red carpet stuff. That was not entertaining television. She was not good at her job. She was not funny. And, you know, if you were on Twitter today, you would have thought that, you know, the fucking Pope died. And I'm just like, I don't get it. I've noticed, it's not just Joan Rivers. It's any time a celebrity dies, it's like this whole Twitter, Facebook, like, listen, you didn't know these people. I understand you might have been impacted by these people, but at the end of the day, you've never met these people, like, most likely. They're not related to you. But you think this is like a family member who passed away, and I just don't get how people sort of, not embrace death, but sort of, what's the word? I guess there's like, they just get wrapped up into this whole celebrity culture where they feel like they are somehow attached or somehow related to this person, when in reality, they don't know who you are. They don't care about you. So, you know, I'm not happy she died. Don't get me wrong. It's a sad story. But at the same time, I'm not going to tweet out, oh, a great legend has died. No. She was terrible at that E! Show. And I'm smart enough not to say this on Twitter, because I don't want to deal with people coming after me sideways. But when you mentioned Joan Rivers, I had to say something, because she was awful in that show. I mean, just like, turn the channel heat awful whenever she was on the red carpet.
Well, let me refute what you're saying, Marcus. I understand your opinions, but
it's one thing to be terrible at your job and be an imitator, but if you're the first person and you make a cottage industry out of this mindless red carpet stuff, which she did, like, I give you respect for that. I don't like what she did. I was never, like, I wasn't watching the Emmys or Oscars or Grammys pre-shows to check out her and Melissa, which is another story I'll get into in a second, but she created something that everybody jumped on. So in that respect, it's like, you know what? I ain't got no problem with you making your money. You created something much like Jerry Springer that did not exist before you really came into the game, and you made your paper.
Fair point. But just to bring it back to sports and or actually wrestling, this is sort of like when Warrior died. When Warrior passed away, Warrior was the greatest human being ever. We all knew Warrior was a piece of shit. We all suddenly forgot all the horrible things that he said in the past because, yes, it was a tragic death, and yes, you know, he was coming off this great weekend of nostalgia where people were happy to see him back in WWE and all that stuff, but, you know, let's call a spade, let's be fair here. There are a lot of awful, awful things that the Warrior did and said, but, you know, if you were that person who was to go against the grain and say something like that, you would have been attacked, so that's all I'm saying is, you know, let's just be fair. When it comes to when people die, you know, I would hope people are fair with me when I pass and they point out the good and bad and not just the good. That's all I'm asking for.
Tell them why you mad, son.
You gotta get a rant. It's just titled The Royal Rant, so there you go.
Well, if you mention that, hopefully that doesn't happen for a long time, but let's say I outlive you, which is probably not going to happen, but if that occurrence does happen, I can't wait for the Alfred Cunningham eulogy. But getting back to Joan Rivers, like, you've seen The Usual Suspects, haven't you?
Yes.
Okay. Well, one of the big quotes from that movie was, the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
The greatest trick Joan Rivers ever pulled was giving Melissa Rivers a career. This chick been eating good for like 15 years with no discernible talent.
Yeah. She, I don't know if she's as bad as Joan Rivers, her mom, but she's also not good when it comes to the red carpet stuff.
I'd say she's worse because at least Joan had qualifications. She might not have been good at a job, but at least she was qualified for it. What did Melissa ever do to say, yeah, let's give her a microphone and put her on TV?
And she at least Joan tried to crack jokes. Melissa didn't even do that. So...
Oh, like one of my favorite Joan Rivers memories, and you know I respected the comedy, especially you know she came up in an era where female comedians were kind of second class citizens. But one of my favorite Joan Rivers memories was, I guess 5 years ago or so now, when she was on The Celebrity Apprentice, and I don't know if you ever saw the clip where her and Melissa got kicked off.
Yeah.
Yo, they went ham. Like it was like you kicking moms off, you kicking both of us off. Which is probably, you know, a true thing in that household, because if Joan goes, Melissa don't have a real concrete fallback plan. So both of them went ham on Donald Trump and the selection process, and they was calling it, I don't even remember who the chick was that voted them off, but they was calling all sorts of snakes and pit vipers and scandalous skeezers and hoes and skip scap scallywops. And that was like, if you want to see some entertaining quote unquote reality TV, look up that clip of Joan Rivers and Melissa Rivers getting kicked off Celebrity Apprentice.
And there you go, that's my favorite memory. She was actually entertaining on Celebrity Apprentice, so there you go, that's something positive.
Like I got friends from all spectrums and all walks of life, but it's funny because like a lot of my more left leaning friends are like, oh, it's a shame she died, but we didn't respect her humor. And it's like, yeah, she was an insult comic to a certain extent, but she was an equal offender. Like she got at white people, men, women, straight, gays, blacks, Jews, whoever.
She's and very much like Lisa Lampanelli.
Yeah. Yeah, like Lisa, right. And, you know, the thing about, like, I thought that, like, there were some clips that a lot of people have been posting today where, like, there's a Holocaust joke she has where if you just hear it at first glance, you're like, whoa. But then a couple minutes later, you're like, you know what? I'm not really cool at laughing at Holocaust jokes, but that's a good one. It's like, you know what? Like, yeah, the stuff she may have saying was kind of crossing the line and being offensive. But as a comedian, she was a damn good joke writer.
Yeah, I mean, you got to be an equal opportunity offensive when it comes to comedy. You can't just single out one group, because that's when you have, you know, troubles. Could you imagine a comedian who just made jokes about black people? Like, how would that go over? Not too well.
I'm sure we had some back in the day.
Yeah.
These niggas over here.
Yeah.
Oh, but yeah, so I'm glad you got that off your chest, Marcus. Yeah, like you, I get sick of kind of the celebrity worship where it's like everybody going crazy over these people that they really did not know except for the TV screen or the movie screen. But, you know,
and not only that, but someone like Joan Rivers, who, when's the last time prior to last week that someone has even mentioned Joan Rivers' name? Like, she,
right.
It'd be different if, even, I mean, same thing with Robin Williams. Robin Williams was sort of like, you know, not in the foreground. He was sort of in the background. You know, if it's someone like, you know, I don't want to name anyone for bad karma or what, but if it was someone who was actively in movies or on your TV or, you know, but both these people.
Like when Paul Walker, to use yes. a recent example.
Yes.
When Paul Walker died, it's like, yeah, because this dude just came off of one of the biggest movies of his life.
Yeah. You know, at least someone who's actually current. But you know, I haven't thought about Joan Rivers in years prior to last week, and all of a sudden it's, you know, it's like the president died. And like, and to the point where NBC actually broke in, NBC breaking news during this afternoon across the national networks to announce the death. And I'm like, I remember the days when like the NBC breaking news alert was saved for like the major like events, right. Like war starting or earthquake or something along those lines, not for a celebrity death. and not for a death that, I'm sorry to say, we all sort of saw coming because of the way the story played out. We knew that she was probably on her last, you know, on her deathbed, just the way they put her on life support. So it wasn't like a tragic death. It wasn't like she dropped dead all of a sudden today. We sort of saw this coming. So I'm done ranting.
Yeah, when you're 81 and you go on life support, it's usually a bad sign.
Yeah, so I just really thought, you know, really, we're doing this on a Thursday afternoon, but all right.
Yeah, so thanks for the memories, Joan, and roast in peace. See what I did there? little comedy thing. Well, there you have it. That is it. Those are our most favorite moments from the year of 2014. I gotta say, Marcus, it was a crazy year both on and off the show, and I can't wait to see what 2015 has in store for us.
Yeah, it was a fun year. 2015 should be just as interesting. I am getting married in 2015, so I'm sure that'll make for a great podcast after the wedding. After the honeymoon, actually. I forgot about that. You're going to be solo for at least another one show in 2015.
I didn't tell at you least. That. Alfred just IN'd me, told me he was coming back.
Oh, really?
For those shows.
Is this show dropping on April Fool's Day?
It's dropping on the 12th of February.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know who we got a pretty strong bench. That's one thing that I like. And we saw it. I will say if there was anything good to come out of all the craziness at the middle part of the year, we got some pretty strong guys that come in off the bench and fill in the pinch. You know, shout out to Dennis Black and Asian and Bobby Fresh and, you know, all of our friends at the Fight Network, John Pollock and Wei Ting, shout out to Morgan Campbell. And then, you know, we got a Sierra, yes, of course, Sierra, who had one of our craziest segments of the year, but it was just too long, and plus it just happened a couple episodes ago, when we talked about HBCUs and Drumline 2, a new beat. So yeah, we got a pretty strong extended family on this program.
Well, I hope you have them on speed dial, because April might be kind of lonely for you.
Well, listen, maybe I'll just have one of my shows where I
do it by myself again and just like we'll get another epic rant about Song of the South and Ron Artest's Panda Shoes.
Yeah, that was that show. That's right.
Yeah. I remember vividly just sitting in my living room like, oh, I wish Marcus were here. But so I could talk to him about Song of the South.
One
of
the most. I haven't found it yet, so.
Maybe, I told you where you gotta go to find
it. Yeah, I know.
You gotta go to some Confederate history sites, Marcus. Some heritage. It's heritage, not hate, brother. Oh, but yeah, we're gonna get out of here. But before we do, again, we want to send a shout out to all of you for listening. We hope that you have a happy and safe holiday season. Want to send a shout out again to all the people that have been on the show, all of the guests, and even the former co-hosts.
Yeah,
you gonna go that far, Marcus?
Sure. Happy holidays, Alfred.
Can we get some peace? Now, at least I need peace.
I had peace once he left the show. I'm good, but you know, if he wants a happy holidays, then happy holidays.
All right. So, yeah, but I'm going to take some time and shout out my family for all the love and support they've shown me the past year. This has been I get people that kind of pop in all the time that have been long-time listeners to the show, and they still ask me about what's been going on with me. And I just got to say that 2014 was much better in every measurable way than 2013, both personally and even professionally. So I appreciate the concern. Shout out to my family. Shout out to my friends and, let's see. Is that everybody? Shout out to my nieces because they listen sometimes. Sometimes
oh, no,
they
actually. Wait. How old are your nieces?
9.
Oh, no.
7
oh,
and
no, no.
1 year old.
No, not the 1 year
old. Happy birthday, Maya.
Maya, cover your ears.
Don't but listen yeah, to this filth. My middle niece, Brianna, was actually on a show one time, like in the background. So we both had screaming children in the background. Oh.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah. So, I think that's it on my shout-outs. Big up Special K, get well soon. Shout-out to my boy Greg. And the people at Zaxby's, man. Come on. Holler at your boy. You trying to get some sponsorship opportunities going.
This is turning to the Soul Train Awards for you giving shout-outs.
Oh, yeah. That would be a shout-out to BET, 106 in Park. I'd like to thank God.
Rest in peace, 106 in Park.
Rest in peace, AJ Free. I'd like to thank my mama, Ray J, big up homie, Bobby Shmurda, free Bobby Shmurda.
Oh man, that dude is screwed.
Hey, it was all good about a week ago. But yeah, that's it for me, Mark. You got any shout outs?
After all that,
there's one person you better shout out. You want a happy holiday season.
Listen, she listens to every show, so I don't need to shout her out. She knows she's listening.
See, you're already taking it for granted.
You know what she pointed out last week, right? That you're a troublemaker, you're an instigator. You like to instigate what? Incidents.
Me?
Yeah, you.
Me?
Yeah. She notices, don't worry. You've been called out.
Hey. Well, thank you for listening.
But I would like to say, would like to shout out the listeners for listening to the show. And, you know, we've been doing the podcast for now almost 2 years, but it wasn't until I went to WrestleMania and, in particular, the John and Way meetup and actually met a listener of our show that it sort of all hit me that, okay, there are people actually listening to the show and they actually look forward to it. And it's a cool feeling. So I just wanted to thank all the listeners for listening. And yeah, that's all I got. Thank you guys. Because without you guys, there'd be no show.
Yep, absolutely. So yeah, we appreciate you. Especially shout out to the friends of the program, Ronnie the Enforcer. Brother Henry down there in South Carolina, Steve up in Toronto. We love all the listeners, but you know, there are some other listeners that have been down since day one.
Jermaine.
Jermaine, Thrill House, Brother Hill House that designed our logos, our imaging for the show. So shout out to Thrill House. So KME, the professor, he's been listening since day one. So yeah, so shout out to everybody that's been listening, and shout out to all our new listeners. And I think that's it. Marcus, where can people find you on social media? I don't know why I'm pausing like Bill Shatner. I was trying to make, you know, do some more emphasis.
Didn't work.
No, it didn't.
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Marco Will, MarcoWill.
All right. You planning on getting into any big beefs with anybody in the new year on Twitter, since that's the hot thing lately?
I think I went 2014 without any Twitter beefs, I believe.
No. 2 weeks ago. Was that a Twitter beef or a Facebook beef with what? Smontel?
Oh, it was Facebook. Schmin VP.
Schmin VP, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He's coming. That's what I heard.
But on Twitter, you were safe.
I was safe on Twitter. I was safe on Twitter. But Facebook, yeah, we had some. It's all good now. We're cool, man. We're cool.
Yeah, so shout out to a Schmin VP. You can find me on Twitter in the number 8, MOZAIK, Nate Mosaic on Twitter. Follow the show, CosPod, KOS_POD. Of course, you can get in touch with us on the Facebook page, Facebook.com/TheKingsOfSport. Again, we just passed 400 listeners. As of right now, we are at 432 listeners. 432 likes.
Lights, yeah, because we have more listeners than that.
Yeah, we got more listeners than that. But 432 likes on the Facebook page, which is, again, you know, it's nice to know that people are invested in the show. And it's not just Marcus and I talking to each other every week, even though that would be cool. But, yeah, when you actually see the show resonate with people and our conversations resonate, that's a cool thing. So check us out on Facebook. Hit us up on iTunes and Stitcher. Rate the show. Review the show. Even if you hate the show, leave us constructive criticism. We're not gonna pay attention to it. But
now we might.
Actually, I will tell you, though, like, funny story on the way out. I did have a conversation with a dude that had a disagreement with the show.
Really?
On Monday. Yeah. This dude is Jamal Weidman.
This on Facebook or?
Yeah, this is on Facebook. And it was when we were having the discussion about Colt Cabana's podcast with CM Punk.
Uh-huh.
And Brother Jamal said, Nate, Colt Cabana did make CM Punk admit that he could be an asshole and hard to work with. Can you and Marcus please do y'all full research before speaking on things?
Listen, so, listen, you know, Jamal, I appreciate your feedback. The podcast was like 11 hours long. I'm sorry. if I might have missed the line, I apologize. But I did my homework because I actually wrote about the podcast for work. So I'm apologizing for missing that one line out of the thousands of words that CM Punk uttered over that 11-hour podcast.
Yeah, I actually wrote him back and appreciated the feedback. But yeah, I pretty much echoed your sentiments that, you know, we never claim to be experts on these things, especially when that thing is an 11-hour podcast. But, you know, we just try to have an entertaining show, a fun show, and sometimes be thought-provoking. So, you know, we appreciate all the love, and we appreciate some of the constructive criticism that we can get. But, we try to do our full research before speaking on things.
Yeah, happy holidays, Jamal.
It didn't sound like you meant it.
Yeah, I meant it. I meant it. Mm-hmm. Jamal, happy holidays.
But that's gonna do it for this week. Again, man, it's been fun. A fun year. We'll see you back next year, man. We got a lot of good things planned in the works. Some more guests. Some more segments. We might, because we're gonna have to figure out a segment to replace Second Down after February.
Oh, it's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you got some suggestions, you know, if you want to bring back the list, if you want to hear about wrestling, I don't know if Marcus will go for it, but you can suggest it.
Man, I can't even watch Raw at this point, so I can't promise you that.
But yeah, just get involved with the show, get engaged, let us know what you want from the show, and we'll see what we can do about it. But that's going to put a bow, literally and figuratively, but maybe not literally, on this particular edition of the podcast, the best of 2014, as well as our holiday edition of the Kings of Sport. I think that's gonna be it for this. I was gonna say for this week, it's gonna be it for this year. Yeah. So shout out to you, Marcus, you and your fiance. It's been fun doing these shows with you, even when the nights have gone long, even when the schedules have gotten crazy. It's been fun, brother.
Been fun, man. Looking forward to another year.
Yeah, we'll have to do it again next year. So, for Marcus Vanderberg, I am the Godfather Nate Milton. Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night. We'll see you next year, if that's all right. You like that?
I like it.
Okay. And you've been down with the Kings.
Well, that's all for this week's edition of the Kings of Sport. Be sure to come back next week for an all-new episode. You can leave feedback for the show on Twitter at KOS_POD or via Gmail at thekingsofsport@gmail.com. Don't forget to like and rate us on iTunes and tell a friend. The Kings of Sport is a production of the Mosaic Podcast Network.
Whether you like it or not, he's back. D-A-double-D-Y, thanks, thanks. Attack like I just left.